good. Are you? Hello, Richard.
Hello.
Are you getting rain?
Yes.
We thought
so. It's supposed to rain all day tomorrow and into Monday.
That's all right.
I've prepared ahead of time.
That's why Richard, that's why Rama played that last song. As long as it doesn't flood everything too much, huh?
Nah, I don't think it will.
Oh, good.
All right, folks, good evening. Let's listen to the Pele Report. And then after that, we'll look ahead into January. There's some stuff coming up in January I ought to mention to you. this week is actually one of the weeks where there's relatively little going on, you know, other than Sun conjunct Pluto tonight and next Saturday and Sun square Uranus next Saturday. But let's see what Kaipacha had to say here.
Okay, Rama. Thank you.
Hola, buenos dias. This is Kai Pacha with the weekly Pele Report. I'm not fooling around on this one. Yes, I am in a city park. I have not scoped it out. I could run into anybody. It's a couple of days before Christmas, and the whole place is nuts with everybody shopping, but we'll see how it goes. It's a beautiful park here. Now, what's up astrologically? Well, you know, we've got still. You know, the moon, as of today, the 23rd, is moving out of Capricorn into Aquarius. So we've just got Mercury, Venus, the Sun, and Pluto still in Capricorn, which I will get to. And that moon is going around. It's going to be in Aquarius, really, up until Thursday. She goes into Pisces. And then on Saturday, she goes into Aries. And we come into our first quarter square, as you can see in the chart that I put with the Pele Report, yeah? We have that first quarter square at 7 degrees of Aries to Capricorn. And then besides that, then she goes into, she actually stays in Aries until Tuesday, goes into Taurus. So, Mercury and Venus are traveling together through Capricorn. If you actually look at the heliocentric position, we have a direct alignment between Mercury, Venus, and Jupiter, and the Sun. You can draw a straight line, yeah, right between these. So it's a planetary lineup there. But that is, the heliocentric. From the Earth perspective, the other big thing that we want to look at today is that Saturn goes into Sagittarius, dun, 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 dun. Since October of 2012, our good friend Saturn has been in the sign of Scorpio, really ripping up the underworld, giving us all some major headaches around our sexuality, relationships, both sexual and financial. And it's moving out, moving on, moving up. The phoenix rising from the ashes is the way that I've looked at it. And, you know, the thing is that it goes there, and it goes right up to 4 degrees, 55 minutes or so of Sagittarius, and in March it goes retrograde. Goes back into Scorpio in the middle of June, and then goes direct, and it's really, officially, in the sign of Sagittarius by September 17th. So You know, it's kind of back and forth on the cusp here. We can talk a little bit about that. We'll see what, you know, see what I got time for. There's lots to talk about. You know, tomorrow, Mercury squares Uranus and conjuncts Pluto. Yeah, that's on Wednesday, day before Christmas. It's like Merry Christmas, folks. Oh, my goodness. It's an intense one, really, because the Sun is somewhat conjunct Pluto. You know, it's coming closer and closer. That square's at 7 degrees. Pluto is at 11, 12 degrees. So it's pretty darn close. It's the Sun is not exactly conjunct Pluto until January 3rd. But, like I say, it's close enough to call it good. And what else? You know, the Moon, the square Moon, is conjunct Uranus and square Pluto. Yeah, on Saturday and Sunday. It's a pretty intense weekend. All right, well, I'm going to find a little spot to settle down here. It's enough astrology, and I'll talk to you soon. Okay, well, forgot what I was going to say. Jeez, it's the holidays, man. What are you going to do? Holidays are holidays. It's family time, and this happens every year, you know. Whether it's Hanukkah, whether it's Christmas, it doesn't really matter. You know, I mean, these man-made religions, human-made religions, stole, yeah, the winter solstice. The solstice point of 0 degrees Capricorn has been here, okay, as long as the relationship between the earth and the sun has been here. And then these religions come along and throw trees and Santa Clauses and candles and oils and all this kind of stuff on it. But the fact of the matter is, in the natural cycle of things, this is a turning point of the seasons. And at this turning point of the seasons, the Sun and now Pluto, Venus, and Mercury are also in Capricorn. And this has to do with our mask, our persona, our reputation. It's how we are seen in the world. It's our office and our duty to look good, to stand up straight, to be tall. Yeah, to do our duties to the family, show up, okay, at the dinners and at the events and at the gatherings and things like that. So this time of year, whether it was Christmas or Hanukkah or any other, you know, see, it would still be a time, is what I'm saying. Holidays or no holidays, this is a time for us to reflect. Capricorn and Saturn have to do with reflection, going inward, and reflecting on also what? The polarity point is Cancer. Our feelings, our past, our childhood, our family, our roots, where we're coming from, this is the time. And the holidays only serve to do it more for us, whether it's because there's, you know, too many people shopping at the store, you know, or, you know, too many brothers or sisters or family members that you'd rather not see or talk to, or, you know, these situations just get us into uncomfortable binds. And it has an intention. Pluto moving through Capricorn, particularly now, has an evolutionary intention. And so we really want to get down beneath, you know, this angst, this stress, this tension. We've got this Uranus square Pluto going on now. It's not going away because it's a holiday. It can be hard to be smiling these days. It can be hard to be laughing these days. It can be hard to really be owning all of the erupting feelings of regret, of grief, of loss. This is really a time where we are going through major, human consciousness is going through a major shift, and it involves letting go of a lot. And the natural human feeling for letting go is of loss, of and having loss is grief. And we're all carrying a lot of grief. And Saturn in Capricorn deals with grief. And our lungs deal with grief. Yeah? Smokers and people that have, you know, lung issues and lung problems, that's grief. These are the sensitive people. Yeah, that have lost a lot and are grieving but don't want to feel. the grief and don't want to feel the loss. And this is where we get into problems. Health problems, emotional problems, mental problems is when we don't feel our feelings. And we continue on with the mask. We continue to smile when we don't feel like smiling. And we laugh when we don't feel like laughing. And we create this false persona, this false reality. And you just can't pull it off anymore. This Uranus moving through Aries is like shocking, kicking us, you know, waking us up to our instincts, Aries, our instincts, our animal self, what we are like feeling right here, right now, in this moment. Aries is anger, it's desire. This stuff has to like wake, it's like waking us up. So we're getting lots of kicks. You know, life is kicking us, shocking us. It's the taser tag. You know, and it's going to be natural. I just want to, you know, encourage you to flow with the feelings, and they call them negative emotions. Well, you know, the light and the dark, the positive and the negative, these are polarities that need each other to exist. And the lower you go, the deeper you go into your own self and into your own feelings and into where you are right now in this moment, the more available you will ultimately be and the more capable you will ultimately be of absolutely merging and having orgasmic, ecstatic relationship experiences outside yourself. But when we don't want to go in all the way, then we don't really know what we need or who we are or what our essential core self is. So obviously our relationships are more superficial and they're going on the surface. And then we don't feel fulfillment or a sense of connection with the outer. But it's because we're not totally connected with our inner. You may want to look at that. I get a lot of people that are feeling disconnected, you know, like I don't belong here and I'm not connected. Well, how connected are you with yourself, with your human emotional needs? So this is a time of really looking at this kind of a thing in the holidays, and life, capital L, is showing us, helping us, teaching us, yeah, how to do that in a more awakened fashion. So, you know, the other aspect that, you know, that this just really brings up, yeah, is this Mars in Aquarius coming into this opposition with Jupiter and this moon in Aquarius on Christmas Day. Aquarius is very non-attached. It's an air sign. It's the head on a stick. It's intellectual. It's the computer. It's the geek. This is not going to be a warmy, fuzzy, cozy, snoozy, luscious, juicy kind of holiday season. Yeah, we got four planets in Capricorn with Mars in Aquarius and, you know, and the moon in Aquarius. Yeah, like I spoke before, you know, these last three signs, Capricorn through Pisces. Yeah, you know, it's very least personal signs and houses. So what it does allow for, what it does do is, and this is really part of it, it's like, you know what? We all are in this place, this time now, as I see it, of instead of reaching in the horizontal for money, security, a sense of purpose, a sense of meaning, and looking for relationships to fill me and feed me and hold me and support me, can't go there. We've got Uranus in Aries. Pluto in Capricorn says, you know what, vertical access, be your own support, and let Gaia, the core of the earth, the spiritual mother, support you from below, and stand straight and tall, yes, to Father Sun, Father Sky, Uranus, Nut over in Egypt, it's actually a woman, but we're not going to go there. And do the vertical, yeah, So it's and then if you're doing your work and you're processing and you're feeling your feelings, and that's the other danger with Mars and the Moon in Aquarius, is to get lost in the head and lost in the future. And all I can say is the head, the thinking, my intellect never knows. I can think, I know, I have ideals. I think that I'm a light worker and that I'm all about love and sweetness and unity and oneness. I think this. This is my ego identity. And then you piss me off. And I have these emotions and these feelings that don't fit who I think I am. That's where the tendency comes to ignore, deny, avoid, suppress. Oh, that's not me. Oh, that's not nice. I'm a nice person. I've got these unnice feelings or desires or needs or wants. But this is the thing. If you want to know yourself, you feel your feelings because your feelings know. I know what I'm feeling. When I know what I'm feeling, it's like my feelings is my truth of where I am right here and now. And you've got to get to that starting point of where you are now before you can get anywhere near the ideal that you want to be. So we can live in the future. We can live in the ideals of Aquarius, Mars, Moon, and Aquarius, and fool ourselves, yeah, delude ourselves into thinking, oh, yeah, da-da-da-da-da, and that feeling will just go away. Oh, that desire is not important. Oh, that, da, 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 da. But every time we do that, we get a little farther and farther and farther away from the shore of our true self. So, the mantra, very simple, this one is, it's okay for me to feel whatever rises within. It's when I distract, deny, or suppress that the trouble will soon begin. And by trouble, I'm talking about health. I'm talking about this Chiron, Neptune in Pisces, Black Moon Lilith in Virgo now coming up to oppose Neptune. This is the axis, the health axis. We're talking stomach problems. We're talking ulcers. We're talking heart attacks. We're talking, when we suppress, we get more anxious. We get more stressed out. It's not good. It's just not healthy. That's what I mean by trouble. And not to mention, obviously, the emotional challenges and, of course, the mental instability that happens when you, are out of touch with yourself. You go nuts. Yeah. Oh, man. One more time for the record. It's okay for me to feel whatever rises within. It's when I distract, deny, or suppress that the trouble will soon begin. Let it out. Let it rip. All this stuff that you're getting triggered. We're going to be triggered all through this time now at the dinner table. It's a nice, happy time. Everybody's smiling. But I'm sorry. It's like, you know what? Bam. Be in integrity, be authentic, speak your truth, and it's going to serve everybody better in the long run. Namaste. Aloha. So much love. Talk at you later.
Hmm.
All right.
Plain as the nose on one's face, what he said today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Don't push it.
It has indeed been a more inner time than usual, at least for us chickens over here, Richard. How about you?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've been running solo here for the last week or so.
Are you okay health-wise?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
I hear you got a little bit of a sniffle there. I can think
yeah,
I hear that.
Well, yeah, that happens when the weather gets damp.
And damp it is.
Yeah.
At least you're not over there in Indonesia or India or Sri Lanka. They're getting flooded like crazy. It's like in decades they haven't had such bad monsoons. Hundreds of thousands of people have lost their homes and tons of people didn't make it and all kinds of stuff going on.
And it's supposed to get down to 11 here.
Again.
Oh, I feel real lucky then. It was 42 this morning when I went outside.
42? We haven't seen that in an age.
You haven't seen 42 for a high, have you?
No, nada.
No, somebody today at Farmer's Market said this is Wisconsin weather, and, you know, let's get rid of Scott Walker.
That won't change your weather.
No, it won't.
Well, it'll change the political weather for a few folks up north, though. That'd be nice.
Yeah.
Hopefully they don't get something worse. That would be awful.
All right. So we had Moon in Aquarius Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, and Moon went into Pisces yesterday or late Christmas Eve. Christmas Day Eve, and Moon goes into Aries in about 4 hours. Uh-huh. And then tomorrow night, the Moon's going to conjunct Uranus in Aries, mm-hmm. So that'll be a little dose of possible.
A lot of fire,
yeah.
Yeah.
And then we start the week Monday with the Moon in Aries, and when it gets into Aries, it's going to do all kinds of things. It's going to square Pluto and Mercury and Venus and trine Jupiter all on Monday. And the Tuesday, the Moon will be in Taurus because it goes in there just before 6 a.m. So Tuesday and Wednesday, Moon and Taurus, not a whole lot else going on. I'm not going to read all the Moon aspects because that would take forever. But New Year's Day then, New Year's Eve, Moon and Taurus and square Mars and Jupiter.
Hmm.
New Year's Eve.
Square Mars and Jupiter, Moon.
Yeah.
Oh boy, two square.
New Year's Day is when that Mars gets exactly opposite Jupiter in the afternoon. And also on New Year's Day, the Moon will be opposite Saturn. Okay, so that's
so Gemini. What kind of energy is that for the first of the new year?
Well, the day most people sleep late, so the moon's going to be void of course in Taurus there at 7 in the morning here on the East Coast, and the moon doesn't go in Gemini until noon, okay? And then afternoon, after that, Moon in Gemini will be opposite Saturn in Sagittarius now, okay? We have to change our thinking. All right, Saturn and Sag, and Mars opposite Jupiter. Now that Mars opposite Jupiter is, it's air and a fire energy together, right? And
expansion.
Mars in the air sign, but it's opposing Jupiter.
That just makes it stronger for you to pay
attention.
Well,
the way I'm seeing it is that look for some flip flop kind of energies.
Oh.
Okay, because Jupiter in Leo tends to lift our spirits.
Yep.
And keep our spirits on the upside. Mm-hmm. But with Mars opposing that, we could flip over into all kinds of negative emotional stuff.
Mm.
So just keep that in mind. Moon, and it's Gemini. And then Friday, Moon in Gemini. And then next Saturday, as we're heading to the end of next week, we're heading towards a full moon. Yeah, heading towards a full moon on the 4th. But right before that, on next Saturday, the moon's going to exactly square Uranus early Saturday morning and conjunct Pluto at 6:30. PM on next Saturday, and Venus goes into Aquarius. So when we get to by the time we get to the 3rd, we're going to have Mars in late Aquarius, 22-23 degrees, and Venus goes into Aquarius on the 4th, late on the 3rd into the 4th. And then Mercury goes into Aquarius on the 5th. Let's see here. Well, late on the 4th, 8 o'clock on the 4th. So full moon in Cancer while the Sun is conjunct Pluto in Capricorn, you see. And that's what Tom was kind of hinting at. Do the vertical axis, do the Capricorn Cancer axis, which is the feminine signs and therefore emotional and magnetic. So that's why where he brings that into, as opposed to the Aquarius energy, right? With Mars and Aquarius, then we're going to add in another week or so we're going to add Venus and Mercury into Aquarius. So this first full week of January, basically that's it until you get to Thursday the 8th with the Moon conjunct Jupiter and opposite Mars. That's on the 8th. And Moon opposite Neptune on the 9th when it gets into Virgo. And that sort of thing. And the other things, other things to look at or keep in mind as we go through January. On the 12th, Mars leaves Aquarius and goes into Pisces. So Mars is moving pretty quickly through Aquarius. And on the 15th, Mars is going to square Saturn. And that's Pisces to Sagittarius, early Pisces, early Sagittarius. That's on the 15th. And what else we got? Venus will be opposite.
I didn't do the last man who asked a question.
Venus will be opposite Jupiter on the 19th, the day before the new moon. So full moon, 15 degrees of Cancer. The next new moon is the first degree of Aquarius. Mercury's going to go retrograde on the 21st. Our first Mercury retrograde of the year in Aquarius.
Oh, Richard. Richard, let me ask you something.
Yeah.
I believe that Barack is going to do his State of the Union address right on that new moon on the 20th when the sun enters Aquarius. What does that look like for him to do it on that day?
Depends on what his advisors advise.
Oh. Right, and then
if you look at it in terms of Aquarius, then the audience is going to be looking at it, listening to it from their mental aspect. Remember, Aquarius is an air sign and has to do with thought and thinking. And of course, that's the new moon. It's the new moon in Aquarius. So the next month when we get done with Capricorn, we're going to go into that month of Aquarius where everybody gets thoughtful.
And if I'm looking at this right, the sun is in Aquarius and the moon is in Aquarius and the moon is conjunct the sun. That's quite a
well. That's round a definition. Table that's there. Definition of a new moon.
Oh, that's right.
And then Mercury goes retrograde the next day.
Mercury goes retrograde on the 21st.
Right, not a good time.
For 21.
Well, it's right before that.
Yeah, let's hope he does it before Mercury.
Oh, something goes right, Mercury. All right. Oh boy.
Remember now when planets get ready to go retrograde, they slow down a little bit. So Mercury, it's by this point, by the time we get to the 18th, Mercury is spending almost 3 days in 17 degrees of Aquarius.
Oh.
All right. And then it spends, a couple of days in 18 degrees Aquarius, and then it goes back into 17 degrees Aquarius, and then it picks up speed again,
Maybe we should go look up those Dane Rudyear reports there on those days, or our sister Cynthia's angels. That might be interesting. Maybe we're going too far.
Yeah, what we can do, that.
A little later, maybe.
Yeah, we could do that. We've got a couple of weeks before we have to face Mercury. Mercury, and of course, Aquarius is electrical. Yeah, Mercury retrograde in an electrical sign could be very interesting, electrically speaking.
Yes.
like computer stuff and cars. All cars have computers in them these days. So it could be
communication.
Murphy could show up.
Communications and those little
lizards.
Those naughty lizards are going to be running around all over the place in Congress. Ay, ay, ay.
Well, there's not too many things that are colder than frozen air. Remember, Aquarius, not only is it an air sign, it's fixed air.
Oh, we got to play that song Frozen for them.
So it's true. We're coming into January. It's the chilliest month of the year.
This is a weird place. I mean, just in terms of, I've been here since
77,
that's right, on and off. But I was here and anchored by 80 something. Yeah. But I'm just saying that January can get nice and warm. I remember sitting in the sun.
Yeah.
In the middle of January. And then it gets colder again in February after Groundhog Day says, okay, 6 more weeks of winter,
Well, and then there's always 6.
Yeah, I know. Always.
There's always 6 more weeks of winter.
Can't we get a little variety?
Yeah, you're going to get variety, but it's going to be white stuff and windy and
Well, it'd be good if we did get white stuff. I mean, we've been getting snow here and there, but it's been kind of powdery and stuff. And we're just droughty still. You know, we're not really getting what we need moisture-wise.
Yeah. Today, the folks that have a place called Agua Fria Nursery on their radio show, they said we're about 5 inches. We need 5 more inches to be out of the drought. That's what they said.
Oh, that's not too bad.
Oh, that's pretty good. Close.
That's pretty darn good, Mama. Oh, boy. Amazing.
Boy. Yeah.
Yeah, nothing like California. Oh, boy. They got a bunch of rain, but, you know, they keep saying you need a whole year of that every day before you're going to be caught up. It's that far down. The aquifers are way below. You know, they don't know what's going to happen in terms of the planting season. There's not really any significant snow in the mountains. And that's where
it's
they get
early. It's early.
Uh-huh. It's not really early when they've been in a drought for 3 or 4 years and it's been getting worse. But it's pretty – it is amazing that
This too shall change.
Oh,
I mean, we had our long drought here in the southeast a few years ago, but we finally got caught up and we got rehydrated.
Oh, well, good.
Yeah, now
– And I remember some years ago in the northeast they had too much rain and all the crops failed because they got too much rain.
Got drowned, yeah.
Yeah. Eeny, meeny, miny, mo. Can we kind of find the word balance in the directions here somewhere?
Where are you going to find balance with Uranus square Pluto?
Duh.
Where you fix
things. I mean, if you look at, if you just go and look at the chart. All the major planets are between early Sagittarius and the middle of Aries, except for Jupiter. Jupiter's on the other side of the circle over in Leo. But you've got Saturn, Sun, Pluto, Mercury, and Venus on one side of Mars, and Neptune, Chiron, and Uranus on the other side of Mars.
And where's Pluto?
Middle of Capricorn.
Sounds like my 10th house almost. Sun, Saturn, Pluto, and Venus in the identical degree, and only in Leo, the opposite.
I go down to Sydney where it's 82.
Yeah, it's very warm in Sydney, Australia. Yeah.
Well, 15 degrees of Cancer where this new moon coming up is.
Uh-huh.
The first half of Cancer is it's in Act 2, which is stabilization. You know, starting with Aries, Taurus, Cancer. You get Act 2 stabilization after they start the creative process. And
uh-huh.
Scene 7 is the first half of Cancer, which is decision. And 15 degrees is in a sumptuous dining hall. Guests relax after partaking of a huge banquet. And this is the need that exists at an early stage of human growth to materialize the concept of fulfillment. And then you follow that right off with scene 8, Cancer 16 to 30, which is consolidation. So we're moving, you know, in that form, you know.
Uh-huh.
We read 1 degree of Capricorn last week.
Yeah, we did.
Which was the Indian chief claiming power from the assembled tribe. So we got that going on. But that's basically about it. I looked at Mystic Mama, and she didn't have anything up to read this week, and neither did the Oracle report. Didn't really have a whole lot in there worth reading to y'all, so we just let that go.
I'll be darned.
I'll be darned. We got Jupiter in conjunct Mercury, so thinking is still a little bit uncomfortable.
Think with your heart.
Well, again, Venus and Mercury are only 4 degrees apart. That's still called a conjunction, you know.
Yeah,
and then you got Jupiter over there, not opposite. Opposite Capricorn would be Cancer, but in conjunct, that's Leo. So it's that 150-degree angle, which is sometimes strange to assimilate. You know, and then you got Uranus is a square Sun, Pluto, and Mercury, you know, all at the same time this weekend. You know.
Well, you know, on Tiburon, a little bit of Tiburon, Metatron came through and he said Mercury retrograde January 21st through February 11th, and then Mercury goes retrograde again next year, May 18th to June 11th.
And it'll be again, Gemini that time.
Uh-huh. And then it goes again on September 17th through October 9th.
Where it'll be
retrograde
in Libra.
Yeah. And it says here, the Mercury retrogrades offer unique windows, especially within the energies of 2015, for clear review of self. The Mercury phase of May 18th to June 11th, 2015, is a time of gathering, a time to collectively co-create. The total lunar eclipse on the full moon of September 28th, 2015, is in a very unusual Mercury retrograde, affording extraordinarily enhanced inner psychic vision. However, it is important.
Hold on a sec there.
Okay.
September
28th.
All right. Let's see here. I'm looking at that now. Okay. It's a lunar eclipse. It's the harvest moon in 3 Aries.
Mm-hmm.
And Mercury goes retrograde on the 18th.
Right.
At 15 Libra.
Well, actually, the 17th.
So when you get to the 28th, yeah, well, close enough.
Mm-hmm.
So when you get to the 28th, that'll be interesting. Look, like, I can't even think about it. That's, you know, 9 months ahead, you know. Oh, please. Yeah, September's got a solar eclipse and a lunar eclipse.
And he goes on and he says in 2015, accordingly, we are in a unique timing in which planetary influences have combined with cosmic forces that are not normally associated to astrological gravities to create a unique and succinctly intense purging in the paradigm of the new Earth. That termed the shadow, the dark side, is in a temporal free flow for a peculiar period of frequential time to bring to the surface repression and frustration, whether justified or not, to be confronted, viewed, and dealt with in the crucible of human experience and manifest reality. That which was hidden or repressed is being percolated to the top. Past transgressions and unresolved conflicts that may have been hidden will surface in this time for facing and responsibly clearing. Well, goody, goody, gumdrops, that would be good. Let it be in a good timing.
There's no point waiting way out then to do that kind of work. We should do that all the time.
Well, yeah, but they're talking now of the whole planet. We're talking about 9/11 stuff, please, and thank you, and you're welcome.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's already up there on a platter. They're talking about it out on the open. Through the first quarter of 2015, those prone to delusion, to occasional grandiose misconceptions or mirage of aggrandized fantasy, will find that this drossy veil will be opened wide into false dream worlds. And these temporarily lost dreamers may well bite the hand that attempts to wake them. Oh, dear. Reality checks offered from even the best intent may result in a confusing, unexpected counterpunch or rejection. It is a time in which even the pure of heart may reject seemingly good-willed advice, much less intervention. It is a phase in which any figure or of authority, right or wrong, may be seen as interfering. Oh, dear. A rebellious attitude is given leeway, even among those not normally fractious, and may influence one to take steps in this rather cloudy frequential phase that would not have otherwise seemed logical. So, Rama, you know, we're going to get help now, right? So we're not going to go and get, you know, dig a deeper ditch. I mean, you're getting it. The inner coyote.
Well, my feeling here is one of cautious optimism. For next year.
So how do you confront something with cautious optimism?
You tiptoe and use a light hand.
Through the weeds.
And, yeah.
That are 20 feet tall everywhere.
Well, remember now, the masses of humanity are going through major emotional and mental changes, both. So.
The inner coyote is released. The teacher has left the room. Oh, I see. And the students are in on their own. Mischief applies as the rules are not as enforceable in this misty frequency. You know, we played a piece right before this time that we're in now, I mean, on the show. And this gentleman was saying that Ecuador is the first country that dropped the entire, you know, way that governance is going and gave rights to the Vilcabamba River. The Vilcabamba River is about 7,000 feet up in the air, just like we're here in Santa Fe. And there's a real progressive, open community there, many people from the United States and Canada. And I mean, it's just like pristine, you know. Hummingbirds are as big as your hand. You know, I mean, they're just very, very lush there, and waterfalls everywhere, and they are gardening and they're building all kinds of alternative communities. And they won. The judge actually granted the river to have rights. Not a person. The actual nature itself. The river itself. And he gave them the win in the court case. I'm sitting here going, holy cow. That's pretty awesome. And there's a lot of places, like, you know, there's at least 80 to 100 little places, or a couple of hundred, I think he said, places, you know, towns and municipalities and all around the place that have done the same thing in this country.
That'll be really good if we can figure out a way to get humanity to start dealing with their recycling issues, right? The pollution is going to kill us if we don't get a handle on it.
I mean, there are some things we can really just put our foot down on. And there's a lot of things that are starting up all over, little seeds. But it could go viral at the same time, because the stuff that's so awful is in your face. It's the way it's saying that this first quarter is going to look like. In other words, it's like It's like having a big old monster that covers all the land, and you either confront it or I don't know what, but declaring the land or the different parts of the land to have rights is a very awesome thing to do. And there's a lot of places, they're not huge places, but like he said, at least a couple of hundred places that have actually succeeded in just starting on their own and setting their own template outside of the system. He actually gave some pretty interesting things. You know, he said that the Constitution's not very democratic. Yeah, we got Thomas Jefferson and we got James Madison and Benjamin Franklin and, you know, John and Thomas Paine and those. Yeah, but the majority of the people did not like democracy in the Founding Fathers' division. And they made the corporation have more of the rights than people.
Didn't trust the useless eaters.
No, and they didn't want to get rid of slavery either. And they sure have kind of done that, you know. And, of course, when there are programs going on and there's sleepy people, we got a big problem. But I think this is a good time for it to be right up there in front in our face and to learn some of these dances. Okay, we got to go off the air. It's time to go. Well, Richard, I love you. Love you. And everybody, okay. Yes. Big hugs, everyone. And we're going to the conference line for an hour, and then we'll be back at BBS Radio, the best radio in the universe. The number is 860-970-0300, and then the PIN code is 13729#. All right, ciao. See you on the other end at the conference. Namaste. Those are real oldies but goodies, but the times have changed so much, and the situation's got a bit hairy, Larry. Oh, my goodness, what was that? Oh, my goodness. Is it somebody in the neighbor or something? You want to play Santa and his magic mushrooms and Osiris and Nibiru and Merry Christmas?
Well,
how long is that?
26 minutes.
Maybe we should play this other one that's a little bit longer first and see how we do. I mean, that would be interesting. Might be a break, but I'm not sure about the time. Patience is definitely a virtue, everyone, and indeed everything is an emergency, as it is in so many ways. Yet there are as many people or more that would like to help. I think she opened the door again.
It's
completely tight?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Okay, so we're in this null zone, in a sense, with Uranus opposite Pluto. And as Richard was saying, in that configuration of the astrological signatures, it's easy to, you know, head first without, you know, being able to deal with the pent-up emotions into something that is, you know, maybe frustrating, or, you know, patience is definitely waning on the timeline, those sorts of things. What, Rama, can you talk up? You want to add your 2 cents?
I would just say that it's like our sister Anne said, we're not going to figure this out.
Anna.
Left brain ain't going to do it. It's going to come from the right brain, and it's going to come from the Nagual, the non-ordinary reality. That's where it's going to come from.
It is.
Yeah.
And full disclosure is going to change everything, and it's already been doing it. There are so many millions and millions of people that have had their experiences with craft. And
take a walk on the wild side.
And it does require that we leave our more structured ways of thinking. They're no longer safe havens. And they were for a temporary amount of time. As you came out of an age of time where you were living in the cave stone age, that happened when the great crystal blew everything up and destroyed the central nervous system of the planet. And a lot of mutations in people's lives, that's happening again. As you were listening just a little bit to our sister, Dr. Caldicott, she's being realistic in terms of the stubbornness of thinking that everything is just fine, and yet using 30% of the resources that aren't ours, and are coming at the expense of lives of people that are being abused and mistreated and killed on a regular basis, so that the hoarding goes on in this country and the misappropriation of money, time, space, and love, you know, air to breathe, is going on. And it's all for the love of money. And I was referring to the Signs of Christ, and Madame Blavatsky was just writing that that was the, I mean, it's in the, you know, in the dedication of this book, and also the Pistis Sophia, Faith in Divine Wisdom, is actually saying in the dedication too. I just read this again. This work is respectfully dedicated to Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, a very great woman who single-handedly rescued our modern world from falling blindly into the depths of dark, hopeless materialism. May our gratitude to her equal the blessings she so abundantly deserves. And indeed, her body of work to bring the masters through for the main body of her lifetime. She lived from 1832 to 1891, when she finally died of poisoning that they gave her. Took about 3 or 4 years, painful death. Nonetheless, she came right back, as we said before, as Manly Palmer Hall, and wrote hundreds and hundreds of books. And The Secret Teachings of All Ages is just a masterpiece. And there's much that has not been taught. These things should be taught in every schoolroom at the proper age, where that necessary information to comprehend the vast, you know, spiritual light that we all carry. So, without ado, I think we'll play this next. This gentleman we just played, Tommy Lindsey, L-I-N-Z-E-Y. He was at that Earth Risk. It's called Earth Risk 2014. He mentioned early on his talk, he said he had a friend named Derek. And though this is his friend Derek, and he gave a talk there too. So let's do this. Let's do this talk. And we're going to move the furniture again. Let's see, where does it go? It goes to the 19... 20. Okay, we're here, Rama. Here we go. Okay, everybody, here we go.
So, I think I want to start by actually asking some questions and just, you know, raise your hands. How many people in the audience think this culture will undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living? Okay, one person raised his hand and then went like this. So we have one person, two people. Okay. How many people think this culture is insane? This is a fairly friendly audience. How many people think the culture is sociopathological? We have a really easy panel tomorrow. How many people think, and for this one, I'm going to list a bunch of things, and if you think that this culture hates one, then put your hand up, and then even if you don't think it hates the others, keep your hand up. I'm very interested. How many people think that this culture hates women? Hates people of color? Hates the natural world? Teaches us to hate our bodies? Okay. How many people think this culture has a death urge? Okay, so what I find really interesting is I basically had a 40 and a half page talk trying to convince people of all these things. So basically at this point, so thank you very much. Good night. Actually, I think now that we understand this, we should do what everybody else in the culture who also understands this in their bodies does, which is we should partay. I'll tell you another thing that breaks my heart, by the way, which is that, I mean, I think this is actually a pretty good crowd for people talking seriously about serious issues. But the thing that breaks my heart is that... how many people will attend the next 49ers game?
Yeah.
You know, I love sports, but it breaks my heart that more people care about the Detroit Tigers than care about real Tigers. And it breaks my heart that since 1975, I believe, or maybe 77, every single University of Michigan Wolverines football game, home football game, has been sold out at 100,000 people. The Michigan Wolverines. And there was a Wolverine in Michigan in 2002, and it was the first one in 200 years. And that breaks my heart. So basically what I want to do then is, since I prepared the talk, I'm going to give it anyway, what the fuck. get rid of that page. Okay, so what I want to talk about actually is why... One of the central questions of my work has always been, why aren't we fighting back? And that's what I really am going to talk about. And sort of as a giving the plot away, one of the things I'm going to try to discuss this evening is that I think that the entire culture is suffering from what Judith Herman called complex post-traumatic stress disorder and is suffering from the learned helplessness that often comes to traumatize people. So once again, I've done the whole talk, so... Thank you very much. Good night. Anyway, the British psychiatrist R.D. Lang wrote, "At this moment in history, we're all caught in the hell of frenetic passivity. We find ourselves threatened by extermination that no one wishes, that everyone fears, that may just happen to us because no one knows how to stop it. There is one possibility of doing so if we can understand the structure of this alienation of ourselves from our experience from our deeds, are deeds from human authorship. Everyone's carrying out orders. Where do they come from? Always from elsewhere. Is it still possible to reconstitute our destiny out of this hellish and inhuman fatality?" And that's really the question. So when you think of Iraq, is the first thing that you think of cedar forests so thick that the sunlight never touched the ground? That's what it was like before the beginnings of this culture. The first written myth of the dominant culture is Gilgamesh murdering the forest defender and then murdering the forests, deforesting the plains and hillsides of what's now Iraq. The Arabian Peninsula was oak savanna. The Near East was heavily forested. Greece was heavily forested. The forests of North Africa fell to make the Phoenician and Egyptian navies. There were whales in the Mediterranean. There were so many whales in the North Atlantic that they were a hazard to shipping, so many whales that their breath looked like fog. It was said that a squirrel could have leapt tree to tree from the Atlantic to the Mississippi without ever touching the ground, or from Maine to Texas. The Great Plains were home to the greatest herds of ruminants the world's ever seen. If you were near a river in California, you would see a grizzly bear every 15 minutes. Of course, there are still are grizzlies in California, in the zoos and on the flags. Here, the hills were covered with trees and the meadows with shoulder-high grasses. A French sea captain wrote, "There's not any country in the world which more abounds in fish and game of every description." Flocks of geese, ducks, and seabirds were so enormous that when alarmed, they rose, quote, "in a dense cloud with a noise like that of a hurricane." Huge herds of elk grazed the grasslands. Sea lions blackened the rocks and were so thick it seemed, quote, "the entire water," end quote, was covered with a, quote, "pavement of sea lions." Whales. Down in Monterey Bay, a European wrote, "It is impossible to conceive of the number of whales with which we were surrounded or their familiarity. They every half minute spouted within half a pistol shot of the ships and made a prodigious stench in the air." Because there were so many whales, beached whales were extremely common and a source of food for everyone. Troops. That's a quote. Troops of grizzly bears would be feeding on the whales. Troops. Now there's not a single one. The animals weren't afraid of humans because the humans who lived here didn't slaughter them wholesale. Foxes were underfoot. Wouldn't you love to live with foxes underfoot? Coyotes routinely came into people's homes, quote, "appropriating whatever happens to suit." Quail were, quote, "so tame that they would often not start from a stone directed at them." Rabbits, quote, "can sometimes be caught with the hand." Geese, according to another visitor, were, quote, "so impudent that they can scarcely be frightened away by firing upon them." That's how the world was. It's all gone. 200 species were driven extinct today by the dominant culture. They were my brothers and sisters. And it's not only non-humans. Indigenous languages are being exterminated at an even faster relative rate than a non-human species. The genocide is ongoing. In fact, it's accelerating. There were at least between 10,000 and 30,000 people living in this region prior to conquest. The culture tried to wipe them off the earth to a minimum of a few hundred around the start of the 20th century. Solid scientists are saying that within 35 years, the oceans could be devoid of fish. Already, oysters and other shellfish are experiencing, quote, "reproductive failure," end quote, which is science speak for the fact that their babies are dying, each and every one. The response by the dominant culture to the melting of the Arctic ice cap has not been one of horror. It has not been one of deep shame. It has not been an absolute determination to do what is right, to rectify the horrors its creation is creating. It has been lust. Lust for the resources it can exploit. The dominant culture is killing the planet. Unless we stop it, it will kill every living thing. Unless we stop it. The culture is sociopathological. It has a death urge, an urge to destroy life. Why is this culture so destructive? And how do we stop it? I've spent 20-some books trying to answer those questions. And so far as the former, here's a spoiler alert. I have no idea. Yeah. No matter what answer we come up with, it's insufficient to explain murdering the planet you live on. I don't care how sociopathological you are. That's fucking nuts. It's insufficient to explain rape. It's insufficient to explain so much of what we see around us. In any case, what I want to do with the rest of the talk is explore some possible contributions to the culture's destructiveness. And my understanding, or my belief, is that understanding the problem will help us determine appropriate responses. It's like a doctor friend of mine says, the first step toward cure is proper diagnosis. If you've incorrectly diagnosed the illness, it doesn't matter how assiduously you follow the cure. It cannot, except by coincidence, cure the illness. That's true on a larger scale, too. Right now, a lot of people are calling to keep the culture more or less the same, but use industrially generated wind and solar electricity to power the economy. Is now the time to mention what happens to birds who fly over solar collectors in the desert? Their wings catch on fire and burn off. Setting aside the practical impossibility of powering the industrial economy using solar and wind, and ignoring the horrible costs of doing so, such as the 18-square-mile open-pit mine in Baotou, China, it ignores that, which Baotou, the name means the place where deer run, and evidently they named it before they started mining for rare earths there. It ignores the fact that burning oil isn't the problem. It's a symptom of the problem. The culture was killing the planet long before it started burning oil. Oil facilitates and escalates it. I'm not saying the oil economy doesn't have to go. I'm saying it's a symptom. And I'm all for treating symptoms, except when we pretend that treating one symptom cures a disease. It often doesn't. In this case, as Darj Mehta said earlier, wildlife has decreased by more than 50% in the last 40 years. That's true from the tiniest arthropods to the largest fish. Nearly all that loss is not because of global warming, which is only now starting to kick in hard. So we need to go deeper. So far as the latter question, how do we stop it? I think that's actually pretty straightforward. If space aliens came down from outer space and they were vacuuming the oceans, changing the climate, putting docks in every mother's breast milk. If they were, I just read this yesterday, the lakes in Canada are turning to jelly. And this is because of calcium. I don't remember why it is. But anyway, I just read this yesterday, that the lakes, I read it in the newspaper, so it must be true. And what? It's okay, acid rain is turning the lakes into jelly. And so if space aliens were doing this, if they were causing all these changes, if they were changing our endocrine systems, by the way, you know, you'd think that if there was one thing that could get people, especially, you know, if that could get people to stop this culture, it would be when your endocrine systems are messed up and you are losing the ability to have sex. It's like, that's not stopping us. So I mean this literally. It's like, what the fuck is it going to take? What the non-fuck is it going to take? In any case, if they were space aliens doing this, we would know what to do. And we would do it. But because it's members of the dominant culture who are doing the culture into which nearly all of us have been enculturated, and never forget that unquestioned assumptions are the real authorities of any culture, suddenly we get really stupid. And we think that the way to stop the destroyers is by recycling or taking shorter showers. Or, and here's the point, by controlling the things that we can control as we assiduously ignore the destroyers who are destroying. Or we might at best appeal to the space aliens to please have the right permits in place before they kill us off. I recently saw a headline that in many states in the United States, the people are facing the choice, not the people, but the states are facing a choice between drinking water and fracking. The newspaper article said this was a, quote, dilemma. Indeed. The article also said that scientists are mixed in their recommendations as to how to solve this dilemma. So the question becomes, why do we not resist commensurate with the problems we face? We are, after all, talking about the murder of the planet. Oh, and by the way, I don't think anybody in this audience will, but I want to say this anyway. Don't quibble with the word murder. Some people, I'll say, you know, the planet's being murdered, and people will say, oh, come on, the planet isn't being murdered. It's like I saw this article about the oceans being killed, but the scientist did not say the oceans are being killed. He said they're being, quote, reorganized. And, you know, they always say, you can't kill the planet. There'll still be some bacteria left. But whenever somebody says that to me, I always ask them if I can borrow a knife. You see where this is going. And then I ask them to hold out their hands. I tell them not to worry. I'm not going to kill them. I'm just going to reorganize them. And I'm not going to do any of this. So what I say is, I'll just cut off your hands. I'm going to cut off your feet and then your arms and your legs. But I'm not going to kill you, for God's sake. I mean, even when your heart stops beating, bacteria will still be alive. So quit worrying. And of course, once again, I'm not even going to stab anybody. That's not the point. The point is that we come up with 10,000 reasons not to resist and 10,000 ways to underestimate the harm that we're causing. So before we talk about some of the reasons this culture is destructive, I want to set aside two reasons that are often given. The first is greed. You know, people always say that. People like on the street, if like on a plane or something, I'll say, you know, I'm going to talk about why this culture is killing the planet, and I'll always say, that's greed. End of story. Sure, greed's part of the problem, but when the planet is being murdered, the problem goes way beyond simple greed. And besides, greed in no way accounts for a lot of the other atrocities that are caused by the same mindset. Greed doesn't account, for example, for rape. Sure, I understand that rape is an act of political terror, and as a whole, acts as a way to terrorize women into submission as a category of people. But that still doesn't explain it. There's an urge to violate, an urge to dominate, an urge to exterminate, to obliterate that goes way beyond greed. And hell, if you recall the descriptions of San Francisco that I gave, the Ohlone people had it pretty easy in terms of gathering food. Would you rather have to work for some big corporation so you can pay rent and buy food, or would you rather step outside your dwelling and then have to shoo away the rest of the geese so you can catch one of them for dinner? It's like, from a perspective of self-interest, the Ohlone had a much better way of life. The other common notion that's thrown out all the time is that humans are inherently destructive. And I've even heard a fair number of people say that intelligence is, quote, a lethal mutation. I'm not sure members of the dominant culture are intelligent. We'll leave that aside. Of course, that's bullshit. Talwa lived where I live now for at least 12,500 years, if you believe the myths of science. And if you believe the myths of the Talwa, they lived there since the beginning of time. And when the Europeans arrived, it was a paradise. Likewise, humans have lived in this region for at least 6,000 years, or since the beginning of time. They didn't trash the place. And the reason they didn't trash the place is not because they were too stupid to invent backhoes. Those who say that humans are inherently destructive have to either ignore the existence of examples of indigenous people, which is what they usually do, or they have to pretend indigenous peoples cause just as much harm as the dominant culture does, which some people like Charles Mann do, or they have, fuck him, or they have to pretend that indigenous peoples didn't do the damage merely because they evidently weren't quite clever enough to invent devices of mass destruction. And there's this very strange and harmful conflation of destruction with intelligence in this culture. Excuse me. I just saw an interview with that asshole, Elon Musk, in which he talked about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. He said that one sign to look for is atmospheric pollution. Seriously, pollution is a sign of intelligence. Frankly, I'm still searching for signs of intelligence within the dominant culture. In any case, never once do members of the dominant culture acknowledge that perhaps indigenous peoples don't destroy their land base because these others aren't insane. But what I'm really getting at is that some humans have lived sustainably, which means it isn't inherent to humans to act like we do. Also, there have been cultures who didn't rape or perpetrate child abuse. If one culture can do it, then it's not biologically determined. To say that the problem is human nature is a cop-out, and it's a lie. It's an excuse to not ask hard questions. Worse, it does what oppressors always try to do, which is to naturalize or make seem natural or inevitable their oppressiveness, their own behavior that's the result of personal and social choices. If you can convince people that this is the natural order of things, you've won. You'd think with all the world at stake, we would not settle for a cop-out and a lie. But we spend more time forcing ourselves to not notice what's going on than we do asking why or trying to stop it. Part of the reason I think it's really helpful to look at the dominant culture with the same sort of dynamic as an abusive family. And R.D. Lang came up with the three rules of a dysfunctional family. And rule A is don't. Rule A1 is rule A does not exist. And rule A2 is never discuss the existence or non-existence of rules A, A1, or A2. So what this meant within my own family structure, which was very abusive, is that we could talk about anything we wanted in the entire world except for my father's violence, which we had to pretend wasn't happening. And on a larger social structure, larger social scale, we could talk about anything we want except for the corporations that are killing the planet, except for the culture that's killing the planet. We can't talk about those key issues. And I guess part of what I was trying to say earlier about greed not being all of it is it's long been really clear to me, even as a kid, that the problems we face are not fundamentally rational or reasonable and are not therefore amenable to rational solution. You know, people come up with all sorts of clever ideas, but clever ideas don't by themselves work because the problem is fundamentally one of insanity. Beyond having your basic creature comforts met, greed doesn't make any sense. Likewise, abuse doesn't make any sense. What the fuck sense does it make to rape one's daughter? Or anyone? Or pesticides? You know, I've been asking forever, who's the idiot who came up with the idea of putting poison on our own food? Or think about this in terms of fracking or anything else. Who's the idiot who came up with the idea of poisoning our own drinking water? Of course, all of these can be made to make sense. Basically, everybody who commits an atrocity has a claim to virtue and has their beliefs and their actions fully rationalized. The Nazis weren't committing genocide, they were purifying the Aryan race. The Americans weren't and aren't committing genocide, they're manifesting their destiny. The capitalists aren't killing the planet, they're developing natural resources. And if Hitler, it was said, from insane premise to monstrous conclusion, Hitler was coldly, icily logical. So they haven't rationalized. So what? It's still all insane. You know, this is the same thing is true on a personal level. I don't know about you, but I have never once in my life been a jerk. Never once. Every time that I was objectively a jerk, I had it fully rationalized. And I would never have done it if it wouldn't have been for A, B, and C, which makes perfect sense to me. Otherwise, I wouldn't have done it. But objectively, I was a jerk. So the fact that the problems aren't fundamentally rational is hugely important, because you couldn't have talked Hitler out of his madness or Ted Bundy. And it didn't take a lot of smarts to figure out that putting in dams kills rivers, which hasn't stopped this culture from obsessively damming, re-killing essentially every river on the planet. And just yesterday, I read an article about the current boom in big dams. And no, it was not the sort of boom that I think most of us would be interested in. Or we don't have to talk about Hitler or Bundy. We can talk about garden variety abusers. How many of you have ever known an abuser? We should form a club. So the question is, were the abusers reasonable? Sure, they could make their own internal shit make sense, and they could gaslight you, but were they fundamentally reasonable? And there's something I call the abuse model, or abuse game, that helps me understand how abusers work. The game's really simple. It's kind of fun, too. One person plays a regular person, and the other person plays an abuser. And the regular person says a sentence, and then the abuser then uses that sentence to try to pick a fight. And the goal of the game is for the regular person to come up with any sentence that the abuser cannot use to pick a fight. It's very, very hard. So the regular person says, "It's a nice day." The other person, "Oh, Jesus, it's easy for you to say after the day I had. Jesus Christ, there you go again. You think I have it easy? You're so narcissistic, I can't even believe it. You think that just because you have a nice day, everybody else must have had a nice day. For God's sake, why don't you ever think about me?" Or, "You're really smart. Oh, so basically you think I'm only up here. I'm too much in my head, Mr. fucking egghead. Too analytical, no empathy. You think I got no empathy? I will show you some empathy right now." I was doing this with a friend one time, and the friend said, "Okay, I got one. You're perfect." Shit, well, I can't do anything with that. I was thinking about it for a little while, and then I got it. It's like, oh my God. You know how hard it is to be put on a pedestal? You know, it's so much pressure. I cannot believe that you would do that to me. I cannot believe how you hurt me like that. Why don't you ever think about me for once? The point of the abuse game is to help us recognize the patterns and to help us recognize that the ostensible subject is not the point. The point is to pick a fight. The point on the larger scale is to not get lost in the rhetoric, but pay attention to what people actually do. The point is not the rationalization. The point is not the stated reason. It's never the stated reason. It's what my horoscope for today, somebody sent this to me. My horoscope for today is that don't pay attention to what people say, pay attention to what they do, which is pretty cool because I'd already written the talk. And that's the whole point of the talk.
The Earth at Risk event brought together thinkers, writers, activists, and many other people of conscience. All of them focused on challenging the old order.
Just a minute, everybody. Just going to fast forward a little bit.
What about the programs that you've helped make possible, like the compelling speakers from Earth at Risk? Enjoy.
I just read this the other day. This was in, I got to show off. I actually read, this is so cool. I read Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. Aren't I cool? Anyway, he has a line in there where Timur the Great, Tamerlane, he actually said he caused wars that killed 5% of the world's population. He actually said that every bit of his conquering was purely defensive. The KKK, of course, claims it is not a hate group, but a love group because it loves whites. Timber corporations and politicians have come up with dozens of excuses for deforestation. Oh, there's the most recent one I heard the other day is that because of the drought in California, the reservoirs are low, and when it rains, if you have a forest, the forest acts like a sponge and soaks up the water, and that water does not end up in the reservoirs, which means that because the reservoirs are low, what you have to do is cut the rest of the forest so that the water will run off, including the sediment, presumably. Yeah, this is real. This is their latest argument. The point is, the urge to destroy is the point. Somebody or another said, "By their fruits ye shall know them." This guy became kind of famous. I think he went on tour. When 99, the tour was cut short, though, somewhere in the Near East. When I had an unfortunate end. When 99% of the native forests are gone, what's the pattern? What's really going on? So so the question is, how did I realize, this is what I was thinking about this for when I was doing this talk, is how did I realize that the culture has a death urge? And it's really simple. You look around and you see 99% of the forests are gone. You see that everybody's going. And the commercial fishing fleets around the world are subsidized at a value greater than the value of their catch. The governments of the world pay fishing fleets around the world more in subsidies than they actually get in their catch. We would all be better off if they simply paid the people to stay at home and sit in their underpants and watch The Price is Right. Oh, it's like they're cutting down the Tongass forest. There's the timber sale they just put out that the subsidy is, I believe, $100,000 per logger. And their argument, by the way, for having to put out this new timber sale is that they had cut so much of the timber already that the sawmills are empty, and so they need to cut more because the loggers are going to run out of a job because they already overcut the forest. Okay, I'm not saying don't educate, and I'm not saying not to use discourse. I'm a writer, for crying out loud. I'm just saying that the first step toward cure is proper diagnosis, and sometimes the talking cure works and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes abusers just have to be stopped. So in a language older than words, I describe the entire culture as suffering from complex PTSD. And PTSD is post-traumatic stress disorder, is when you have been traumatized. If you've been traumatized, you may later on experience flashbacks when you get reminders of it. So, for example, if a woman was raped in a certain make and model of car, then whenever she sees that make and model of car, she may have fear associated with that. Or, you know, the cliche is of the combat veterans who, if they hear a car backfire, they jump. Or my mom was in a terrible, terrible car wreck, and it was on a dark and rainy night. And so when she's a passenger in a car on a dark and rainy night, she is very tense. We're all fairly familiar with this. And then Judith Herman talked about something called complex post-traumatic stress disorder, which is, she asked, what happens if people are not traumatized once, but they are held captive? What happens if they are prisoners, or if they are raised in captivity, as in victims of domestic violence, survivors of domestic violence? What happens? There are other things that happen to you beyond the more simple post-PTSD. I'll get to some of the symptoms in a minute. But before I talk about those symptoms, I want to talk about some of the symptoms of this culture. Excuse me. So many indigenous people have said to me that the fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that even the most open-minded Westerner generally perceive listening to the land as a metaphor, as opposed to the way the world really is. Another way to say that is that Westerners generally perceive the world as consisting of resources to be exploited, as opposed to other beings with whom we can enter into relationship. Other beings whose lives are as valuable to them as yours is to you and mine is to me. Other beings who are every bit as alive and sentient as are you or I. And that, of course, includes not only other animals, but plants and rivers and mountains and forests. And, of course, how you perceive the world affects how you behave in the world. There's a great line by a Canadian lumberman. When I look at trees, I see dollar bills. If when you look at trees, you see dollar bills, you're going to treat them one way. If when you look at trees, you see trees, you'll treat them another way. If when you look at this particular tree, you see this particular tree, you'll treat it differently still. Same is true for women. If when you look at women, you see orifices, you're going to treat them one way. If when you look at women, you see women, you'll treat them another way. If when you look at this particular woman, you see this particular woman, you'll treat her differently still. And one of the fundamental flaws of this culture, I think, is the perception that the individual is the fundamental unit of nature, or the fundamental unit of evolution, or even worse, that the gene is the fundamental unit of evolution. I think we are ourselves, of course, and we're also parts of a larger whole. Likewise, a tree is itself, and it is part of a larger being. A forest is a living being. A river is a living being. Now, before you laugh and say a river is just a container through which water flows and happens to be filled with other beings, let me ask you, when was the last time you had a drink of water? And let me ask you, when's the next time you're going to pee? Let me remind you that water is flowing through you. And let me ask you, what percentage of you is water? And let me remind you that more than 90% of the cells in your body don't contain your DNA. And let me remind you also that the bacteria in your body are going to outlive you. Some of them are just waiting for you to die to start eating you. You could easily be considered a container through which water and nutrients pass, just like a river, and you are habitat for lots of other creatures, just like a river, which doesn't mean that you aren't yourself. Part of our problem is that we perceive bodies and forests and rivers and mountains as though they were human-created artifacts. There's nothing to a chair except its parts. I can take apart a chair, replace the screws, let it sit on my floor for 3 months, and then put it back together, and I still have a chair. You can't do that with a body. Someone can't take apart your body bit by bit, put it all back together, and still have you. The same is true for a forest. You can't take a redwood forest, remove the salmon and the grizzlies, and expect the forest to be the same. Of course, you can survive without a lung, and evidently most human supremacists can survive without using their brains, but you are more than the sum of your parts, as is every other living being, which means as is everyone. And while we're talking about this, I'd like to debunk the harmful notion that evolution is based strictly on competition. I know we've all been taught that it's based on survival of the fittest, which is supposed to mean survival of the meanest, most exploited, most capitalistic. That's just a projection of the dominant mindset onto the natural world. As we'll see, the result of a traumatized psyche. It's an attempt to naturalize this culture's awful and exploited behavior. See, everybody exploits. We're just really good at it. We're number one. I can debunk this in one sentence if you give me a couple semicolons. Those creatures who've survived in the long run have survived in the long run. Semicolon. You don't survive in the long run by hyper-exploiting your surroundings. Semicolon. You survive in the long run by improving your habitat. It's not survival of the fittest. It's survival of the fit, meaning how well you fit into your natural surroundings, how much you make the world a better place by your existence. Is the world a better place because you were born? Not the culture, the world. Oh, this guy wrote to me the other day and said, who cares if salmon go extinct? And I wrote back and said, well, first off, forests care. Second off, I care. And the real question is, who cares if you die? I don't think he was applauding. How do you think that the world became so wild and fecund and beautiful and full of life in the first place? It was by everybody living and dying. That's how it becomes better, is everybody improves the world by their lives. That's how the world has to work. And it's a measure of our collective stupor that we don't all know this. You know, scientists also love to talk about one of the ways we learn things is by creating a model and then seeing how the application of that model affects the experimental subjects. So I can hypothesize, and if it doesn't affect them the way you think, then your model is probably wrong. So I can have a hypothesis that humans can survive on Lucky Charms. So then I feed someone Lucky Charms and Lucky Charms alone, and if this person gets sick, I presume that my model is incorrect. Okay? But here's the deal. The dominant culture has been acting on the notion that natural selection is based on hyper-exploitation, and it ain't working. The entire world's being murdered. If they were space aliens who were conducting this experiment, we would all see them as completely insane. But once again, because we've been inculcated into this culture, because we too have been made insane by the culture, we can't see it. I want to mention one more thing before I move on, which is the great chain of being, which is really fundamental to this culture. It's the notion that all life is hierarchical. God's at the top, and then angels, and then the king, and then regular dudes, and then women, and then, quote, primitives, who are halfway between humans and animals, and then animals, then plants, then rocks, soil, and so on. Obviously, this hierarchy was developed by kings and their allies. Which, by the way, have you ever noticed how when somebody develops one of these hierarchies, they always end up at the top? It's an amazing, amazing coincidence. Oh, it's like the whole thing. You know, I just love this, the nomenclature. Humans are called Homo sapiens sapiens. It's like, for the longest time, I thought they just added the second sapiens to make sure we got the joke. What sapiens means wisest of the wise, Homo sapiens sapiens. I guess I should have told you that first. What sort of egomaniac would label themselves that? It's like, I'm going to create a new system of nomenclature. It's Derek sapiens sapiens. Thank you very much. So here's the deal. Even though we don't generally believe in the divine right of kings anymore, the great chain of being still pervades our thinking. So many of us think that humans are the pinnacle of evolution, or think that animals are more sentient than plants, and so on. Basically, somebody else's sentience and beingness is determined by how closely it resembles ours, which is really narcissistic. And frankly, the divine right of kings hasn't gone away anyway. It's become the divine right of humans, or rather, the divine right of humans in dominant culture. Just like the king was appointed by God to be able to take whatever he wanted and fuck whomever he wanted, humans now consider themselves to have been appointed by evolution as being able to take whatever they want and fuck over whomever they want. Why else would it be even considered even remotely okay to kill the oceans, or for that matter, San Francisco Bay? So what does this have to do with complex PTSD? So years ago, I asked trauma expert Judith Herman about the symptoms. She said, quote, "In the aftermath of trauma, people see danger everywhere. This seems to be a biological phenomenon, not just a psychological one." She's just described this culture. Indigenous peoples tend to see the world as their home, their provider, as opposed to this culture that tries to get us to believe that nature is red in tooth and claw, that all creatures ought to get us, so we've got to get them first. By the way, I'm also just curious, how many people in here hate the animal planet? Oh, for God's sake, there's only like 5 of us? Sorry, oh, the animal planet's great. It's a wonderful show. It's one. No, it's just terrible. It's like supposed to be about nature programs, but they're all these horrible programs. Like, have you ever noticed that whenever you see a carnivores, like if there's a lion on a nature program, the lion is going to be killing a gazelle. Always. You know, lions will have sex like 20 times a day. And unless you're watching David Attenborough, you don't learn about the sex habits of non-human animals, in which case David Attenborough is very excited. Or like spiders. You know, if you see a spider, it's eating a fly. A lot of species of spiders eat like once a year. I mean, they spend all their time just thinking spider thoughts. So anyway, another group of symptoms has to do with a shutting down of feelings, a constriction of emotions, intellect, and behavior. So constriction of intellect, that's how people can put poisons on their own food. You know, it's not very smart. They kill every river. You know, we learn the ability, the capacity to think. Constriction of emotions, that's how people can vivisect. They can have factory farms. That's how people can rape. Know that all of those are about control. She also said that people can oscillate between feeling overwhelmed, enraged, terrified, desperate, or in extreme grief and pain, and feeling nothing at all. They can oscillate between feeling overwhelmed, enraged, terrified, desperate, in extreme grief and pain, or feeling nothing at all. There you go. I mean, that's most of our response to the murder of the planet. I mean, for that matter, that's most of our response to our jobs. And now we start to get the real point. Judith Herman said, because people in captivity are most often isolated from other relationships, they're forced to depend for basic survival on the very person who's abusing them. This is classic to abusive relationships. And about being cut off from other relationships, how much more cut off can you be than to be cut off from the source of all life? You know, ask yourself, how many machines do you have a daily relationship with? Car, clock, computer? How many wild plants or animals do you have a daily relationship with? Remember, you see a grizzly bear every 15 minutes here. Like right now, how many machines are within, you know, 20 feet of us? How many wild animals are within 100 yards of us? We often think of cities as places of sensory overload. At least I do. On tour, I go to my hotel room and I pull the drapes shut and I don't go out except to eat because it's all just too painful for me. I feel abraded at the end of the day. But there's a deeper way that it's a place of sensory deprivation. How much of your sensory perceptions originate in or are mediated by human beings, or worse, by machine creations? How much of our sensory perceptions comes from non-humans? This is not how we evolved. This is not how we're supposed to live. We're listening only to ourselves. And people in echo chambers begin to hallucinate. This is what John Livingston thought was a source of our ideology and our customs, the hallucinations of those suffering sensory deprivation. It certainly makes sense to me. And if all your perceptions originate in or are mediated by humans, you can come to believe that humans are the only things that truly exist, and certainly the only things that speak. The monopolization of perception is really classic to abusive relationships. One of the reasons that if an abuser can cut you off from your other social relations, the abuser can convince you that the abusive way is normal. It wasn't until she was in eighth grade that my sister knew that not all fathers rape their daughters. So if you can get people to believe that this is absolutely normal, there's no reason to fight it. We always have to struggle to remember there are other ways to be. That's one reason that Milan Kundera wrote that, Vaclav Havel, some guy from Eastern Europe, said that the struggle against depression is the struggle of memory against forgetting. And that's one reason that those in the dominant culture must destroy or assimilate every indigenous culture it can. And it's one reason they have to destroy or domesticate wild nature. Because people must never know that there is or ever has been any other way to be. That's their best tool for getting people to not resist. As the Catholics used to say, outside the church, there is no salvation. As scientists say, outside science, there is no knowledge. And as so many of us seem to believe, outside civilization, there's no life worth living. isolating us makes us dependent on them, not only perceptually and socially, but physically. That's true on the level of the individual abuser, and it's true on a larger social scale. From the beginning, those in power have wanted to separate us from the land. It's one of the primary ways they control us. The early cities had walls not around the outside of the city, but around the granaries, because they knew that if the king could control the food supply, he could control the worker supply. It's like John Mohawk always said, there is no sovereignty without food sovereignty. And there was a 1830s Southern pro-slavery philosopher who wrote to his Northern abolitionist buddy saying that there are land ownership conditions in which it's in the capitalist's best interest to own slaves, and land ownership conditions in which it's the capitalist's best interest to not own slaves. It's very simple. There's a lot of land and not many people. It is in the capitalist's best interest to own slaves, because if there's a lot of land and not many people, people have access to land, which means they have access to food, clothing, and shelter, which means they have access to self-sufficiency, which means that they will not go to work for you except at the point of a gun. On the other hand, if you have a lot of people and not much land, that means they don't have access to land, which means they don't have access to self-sufficiency, which means that they will have to go to work for you for whatever pittance you want to pay them. And so in that case, as a capitalist, it is not in your interest to own them. And they've known this all along. And so one of the reasons that we don't resist is because our experience is that our food comes from the grocery store and our water comes from the tap, which means we will defend to the death that system, because that's what's keeping us alive. We have been made dependent upon the system, just like any good abuser is going to make you dependent upon them. And if, on the other hand, your experience is that your food comes from a land base and your water comes from a river, you'll defend those to the death because your life depends on them. All this is crucial to capitalism. Two more quotes from Herman about complex PTSD. The abuse captivity, quote, creates a complicated bond between the two and skews the victim's perception and nature of human relationships. The situation is even worse for children raised in those circumstances, because their personality is formed in the context of an exploitative relationship, in which the overarching principles are those of coercion and control, of dominance and subordination. Whether we're talking about adults or children, it often happens that a kind of sadistic corruption enters into the captive's emotional relational life. People lose their sense of faith in themselves and other people. They come to believe or view all relationships as coercive, and come to feel that the strong rule, the strong do as they please. They believe that all relationships are contaminated and corrupted, that sadism is the principle that rules all relationships. She's just described this culture. Might makes right, social Darwinism, selfish gene theory, original sin. That right there describes the principles that undergird the entire political, economic, scientific, and religious systems. That's it. And even more, they reach into our epistemology itself. Epistemology is a study, really, of how we know what's true. Richard Dawkins has stated that, quote, science bases its claims to truth on its spectacular ability to make matter and energy jump through hoops on command and to predict what will happen and when. Science bases its claims to truth on its spectacular ability to make matter and energy jump through hoops on command and predict what will happen and when. And that's true. When you flip a light switch, the lights go on. That's how we know that science is working, that science really knows how the universe works. But he's done something really sneaky, which is he has conflated domination with how we know something's true. And to think about this, just think about this. Let's pretend that I have a hoop and I have a gun. And I put the hoop right here and I point the gun at you and I say, okay, on the count of three, you're going to jump through this hoop or I'm going to shoot you. So on the count of three, you jump through the hoop. What do you know? I'm a fucking genius. I just predicted what will happen and when, and I just made matter and energy jump through hoops on command. But don't you think it's possible that by doing that, I foreclosed all possibility of friendship? There are other ways to know. And science is one way that is based on control. And our entire epistemology, it doesn't really get more basic than epistemology. And that has been corrupted by the notion of control. Herman continued, there are other losses involved. A loss of basic trust, a loss of feeling of mutuality of relatedness. In its stead is emplaced a feeling of contempt for self and others. That's what we see around us. How much more contempt can you have for another being than to deny that they even have subjective existence at all? And clearly we as a culture feel contempt for the natural world, or we wouldn't destroy it. And clearly we have contempt for ourselves, or we wouldn't put up with any of this shit. We wouldn't put up with dioxin in every mother's breast milk. I mean, that's nuts. We wouldn't put up with corporations having control. We wouldn't put up with any of this stuff. She continues, if you've been punished for showing autonomy, initiative, or independence, after a while you're not going to show them. In the aftermath of that kind of brutalization, victims have a great deal of difficulty taking responsibility for their lives. Often people who try to help get frustrated because we don't understand why the victims seem so passive, seem so unable to extricate themselves to advocate on their own behalf. They seem to behave as though they're still under the perpetrator's control, even though we think they're now free. But in some ways, the perpetrator has been internalized. That's it. That's it exactly. I keep asking why we don't fight back. The world's being murdered, and for the most part, we aren't doing shit. And of course, those being abused or held captive have to learn to identify with their oppressors. They have to. They have to care deeply how their oppressors are doing, and they have to cater to their captor's whims, because an unhappy captor is more likely to harm you. We see this on every scale, from the most personal to the most ecological. Oh, for God's sake, I don't really have time for this, but yesterday I got detained for 45 minutes at the San Francisco airport over something that was completely fucking ridiculous. Oh, they said I was smoking marijuana in the bathroom, which I wasn't. And so they detained me for 45 minutes. And the cop was a prick. I wouldn't have minded if he would have been polite. You know, we had a report, blah, blah, blah. But he was a complete asshole. And I kept saying, I don't have a lighter. I don't have a vaporizer. I don't have anything. I don't have any pot. I don't have anything. He's like, okay, so you destroyed the evidence. He kept saying, so I would not be here if you had not done something wrong. I was like, well, dude, the logic doesn't actually work. But I did not say to him, dude, the logic doesn't actually work, because I knew if I did, I would be face down on the ground with handcuffs on. So the point is that I had a captor. I mean, he was a captor at that moment. So I was reasonably polite and, as they say, compliant. And, you know, it's the same thing happened one time when I was going through TSA years ago. This TSA agent put her hand on my pants. I said, you're putting your hand on my pants. And she said, I'm doing this for your safety. I said, no, this is not actually for my safety. And then she said, would you like for me to call over the police? And I had a choice. I could either make a scene or I could get the hell out of Austin, Texas. And so what I did is I got the hell out of Austin, Texas. I shut up. My point is, it makes a lot of sense when somebody has control over you to be compliant. But then we internalize it. We naturally, that's what happens. And so we end up caring more about the health of the system than we do about the health of our own bodies.
It goes without saying that Ling TV is not your...
Hold on, everybody.
...global warming that's presented in the mainstream have in common... What they all have in common is they take industrial civilization as a given and the natural world as having to conform to industrial civilization. When did environmentalism stop being about protecting the natural world and start being about, quote, sustainability, which is about sustaining this way of life that's killing the planet? That's fucking outrageous, outsane. It is insane in terms of being out of touch with physical reality, because the health of the planet must be primary, always. Without a planet, you don't have any social system at all. But that's not how we think, because every action must be to protect the system. Right after Fukushima, one of the Japanese energy ministers said that they have to keep going with nuclear power because, quote, we can't imagine living without electricity. So I was thinking a few things. One of them is, well, right now about 2 billion people on the planet live without electricity, and they do very fine. Also, humans did fine up until about the turn of the, you know, maybe 1920, before that, without industrially generated electricity. We basically were on 5 continents, and we were doing very well. And you can't imagine without electricity, but the main thing that hit me is that, have you ever heard some public official say, we can't imagine living without polar bears? We can't imagine living without monarch butterflies? We can't imagine living without the Colorado River reaching the ocean. We can't imagine living without living oceans. We can't imagine. That's the problem, is a failure of imagination. That we can't imagine living without Wi-Fi, but we can imagine living without salmon. And have you ever noticed that every fucking news article about some creature being driven extinct always refers back to the economic effects of this extinction? This pisses me off. Quote, ocean acidification due to excessive release of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere is threatening to produce large-scale changes in the marine ecosystem affecting all levels of the food chain. A scientist warned that ocean acidification also carries serious financial implications. The aquaculture industry is deeply concerned. They're trying to figure out basically how they can avoid going out of business. Headline, revealed how global warming is changing Scotland's marine life. First sentence, global warming could cut commercial fish catches around Scotland by 20%. CBS News headline, saltwater fish extinction seen by 2048. terrible news for the entire planet, right? Well, we know what's really important. One of the researchers is quoted as saying, if biodiversity continues to decline, the marine environment will not be able to sustain our way of life. So, I say to you, I've heard that every member of your family is dying from poison released by the factory I put in next door. You look pretty sick. I bet you're not going to last another month. And your kids? Oh my God, that's one of your children. Is she still alive? She looks... This is just awful. It's unbelievable. I'm so sorry that you're all dying, because if you die, who's going to work in my factory? And I'm going to go out of business. That's it. So, one piece of this puzzle is this culture's incredible destructiveness. We're all insane, having been driven so by this horrible culture. We're acting out the symptoms of complex PTSD. Well, and part of what all this adds up to is a desperate need to control, not only because what we control has less chance to hurt us, but also because anyone or anything who is wild and free will remind us of who and what we were before we ourselves were traumatized, before we ourselves were enslaved. That's too painful. So we have to destroy every reminder of who we were. Instead, we have to control. We have to assert control. We must be the ones who do too, not the ones to whom it is done. And that need to control is killing the planet. Okay, that's all fine, but I don't think the trauma is enough to explain this culture's behavior. It's not good enough to simply act out your issues. Those who are still sane are going to call you on it. What you need to do is to systematize your insanity. Instead of just saying, for example, that men are superior to women, what you need to do is to create a god, male of course, and get him to say it. Then everybody who disagrees with you isn't just disagreeing with you, they're disagreeing with the big guy himself. They're not merely breaking your law, but God's law, and God knows if you've been naughty or nice. It may take a little work, and it may take a few beatings to convince the women that God's on your side, but if the beatings are fierce enough to, as they say, put the fear of God in them, it's going to pay off in the long run. It'll be a lot less work later. It'll make your job of oppression ever so much easier. And the same is true, by the way, with making your God white and human. And while you're at it, go ahead and tell your God to tell you that you should go forth and multiply, that you should have dominion over the earth, that you should conquer everybody who doesn't believe in your God. Then you have a claim to virtue ready-made for everything. And if you keep up that pressure for a few generations, your abusiveness will become codified. And that's really the point, because any hatred felt long enough no longer feels like hatred. It feels like religion, or it feels like philosophy, or economics, or law, or science, or just the way things are. As the United States Supreme Court said about land theft and genocide, if your entire way of life is based on it, quote, it becomes the law of the land and cannot be questioned. That's Johnson v. McIntyre, I don't remember which. And that's when you've really got them. And I'm going over time, so I'm going to cut all my Ruth Benedict stuff. Basically, the Ruth Benedict stuff, actually, I guess I won't cut it. The Ruth Benedict stuff is she wanted to figure out why some cultures, people are fairly nice, and other cultures, there are a lot of people really surly or nasty, and why women are treated well in some cultures and treated poorly in others, why some cultures are very warlike and others are pretty peaceful, why people are generally happy in some cultures, why they're not so happy in others. And it all fell down. This is some really simple rule. And what it is what she found is the good cultures had figured out that humans are both selfish and social. And they got rid of this selfishness, altruism, bifurcation by praising behavior that benefited the group as a whole and by disallowing behavior that benefited the individual at the expense of the group. So what this means is that if you do something good for the group, you get praised, which means your most selfish act is to give to the group. And on the other hand, the bad cultures, the cultures that were very warlike, that treated women and children very poorly, were the opposite, where they reinforced behavior, they socially reinforced behavior that benefited the individual at the expense of the group, and they did not reinforce behavior that benefited the group. And there are many ways to doing this. There are nations in the Pacific Northwest who had what's called a shaming poll, which is if somebody does something really bad, you put a poll outside their house that basically says, I'm a jerk. And that's a form of discouraging that behavior. And really what she found is it all came down to how culture handles wealth. But if the culture handles wealth through what she called a siphon system, whereby wealth is constantly siphoned from rich to poor, everybody in your community is happy. because everybody's secure. Because if I catch salmon and I keep it all to myself or I try to sell it, then they would put a shaming pole outside my house, or somebody would. On the other hand, if I catch it and I give it, then everybody, I gain esteem, which is what we really care about as communal creatures. We want to be accepted and celebrated. And the other cultures, on the other hand, think capitalism, would benefit behavior. They would reward. Like, we all know who Bill Gates is. Why do we know who Bill Gates is? Because he accumulated a lot of money. That's it. And if you have a social... it's very simple. Basically, people do what they get rewarded for. That's it. And what she found is that good cultures reward good behavior and bad cultures reward bad behavior. I don't know why it took an anthropologist to figure that one out. Okay, so there's something else. The next level is once you... what we've talked about sociological and psychological reasons. You know, actually, I think I might... I want to talk about physical reasons, too. I want to talk for just a moment about agriculture. As you know from earlier, basically what agriculture is a way to... agriculture is the conversion of entire land base to one use, like the plow agriculture. And one of the things it does for you is it allows you to have your population expand. One of the disadvantages is that it destroys your land base. So once you've committed yourself to this path of having a lot of people on that particular patch of land of overshoot, that means you're either going to have to collapse because you've destroyed your land base, or you're going to have to expand. And the disadvantage of this is that there are other people who are already living on the land next to you. So one of the things this means is once you've committed yourself to that life, you're going to have to be militaristic. You're going to have to keep up this conquest. But one of the advantages of this way of life is if you destroy your land base and turn it into machines of war and into standing armies, you have a competitive advantage over the cultures who don't. And this is a problem that we need to solve, and I don't know that we've ever really faced it. I'm saying this very poorly, but the point is that once you have committed yourself to a way of life based on the drawing down of the land, you not only have committed yourself to a way of life that has no future and a way of life based on conquest, but you have also given yourself a competitive... if you destroy the rivers to make electricity so that you can build tanks, you're going to have an advantage over people who didn't do that. But then you've committed yourself to it, so it really puts those of you who don't actually want to have that lifestyle in a very difficult position that we have yet to be able to figure out how to stop. I'm going to skip down. And thank you. It's not just agriculture, it's the theft of all other resources too. I'm always kind of surprised by how many sort of anti-empire activists still want the fruits of empire, who seem to think you can have the fruits of empire without having actual empire. But basically, in one form or another, all of our energy and consumer goods comes from empire. I'll talk about that in a second, but I'm sort of muddling here for a second, but I was thinking about this. Last year I did an interview with this guy from Nature Online Journal, and Nature Online is just dreadful, just dreadful. Anyway, one of his questions was this, and this is back to this question of why drop agriculture. I just blew that. Why we're killing the planet. One of his questions to me, this is from Nature Magazine: surely nature can only be appreciated by humans. I like this audience. If nature were to cease to exist, nature itself would not notice. You know, I hope the journalist who asked me this question listens to this. As it is not conscious, and other than through life's drive for homeostasis, is indifferent to its own existence. Nature thus only achieves worth through our consciously valuing it. Okay, I'm not making this up. At the precise moment he said this to me, I was looking out the window at a mother bear lying on her back in the grass in the sunshine with her two cubs playing on her belly. I said to him what I was looking at, and I said, do you mean to tell me that she is not enjoying being on the sunshine with her children? And he said, yes, that's what I'm telling you, is that she does not have the capacity to enjoy. And I said, have you ever known any bears personally? And he said, no. And he thought the question was absurd. And that is why the world's being killed. There was another thing he did in the same conversation that was very interesting to me. 10 minutes? Holy fuck. Okay, so I'm going to talk like an auctioneer for the rest of the time. I'll tell you the story real quick. But the guy, he also said this thing. He said that he believes that we should have non-exploitative economic systems, and only all exchanges should be purely voluntary. And so I said, okay, great, that sounds wonderful. And he thinks that that can happen within an industrial system. I said, okay, great, wonderful. In a city, how are you going to get around? He said, buses. I said, okay, great. What are you going to make the buses out of? And he said, metal. I said, okay, great. Where are you going to get the metal? He said, mines. I said, great. How are you going to get people to go in the mines? Because people don't want to go underground and work in mines for the most part, and that's one of the first forms of slavery, really. And he said, you pay them a lot. I said, okay. Do you accept that mines are actually very destructive of the environment and it will destroy, say, the river that is right next to the mine? He said, yes, but that's nature, and nature doesn't care about its own, so nature doesn't count. I said, okay, fine. There are some humans who live on this river, and they don't want their river to be destroyed. What are you going to do about them? He said, you pay them. I said, okay. What if they don't want to leave? He said, you pay them a lot. I said, what if they really don't want to leave? He said, you pay them even more. I said, okay, what if they've been living there for 5,000 years and their ancestors are on this land and they refuse to leave? He said, how many of them are there? I said, I don't know, 600. He said, well, there's 1 million people in the city, so we vote. And the million people in the city vote, and so then we remove them. I said, do you realize that you have gone in about five sentences from purely voluntary exchanges to democratic empire? That's how this works. And he said, I don't know what you're talking about. Okay, well, I didn't actually get to talk about the depressing part of my talk. Okay, I guess what I want to say is I want to do like a 2-minute version of Lewis Mumford. People know Lewis Mumford? Oh, a few people. Lewis Mumford talked about something called a technic. And a technic is a technology does not emerge out of nowhere. It emerges from a technic is the social circumstances that give rise to and then emerge from a technology. So the Talua did not create chainsaws, not because they were too stupid. Instead, they created different technologies, like, for example, salmon welcoming songs. Their social circumstances would lead to that form of technology. Our social circumstances would lead to, our mindset would lead to chainsaws. And then also, once you have a technology, it changes how you perceive the world. So I live 3 miles from a grocery store, and if I do have a car, then I can drive to the grocery store, I forget something, it's no big deal. Distance doesn't matter. But if I don't have a car, then 3 miles, that's a long ways to walk to the grocery store. So a technology then changes how I perceive, you know, traveling from Crescent City to San Francisco would be a job of, I don't know how long it'd take me to walk this far. I wouldn't do it. And so it changes how we perceive the world then. And he said that technologies will fall into sort of democratic and authoritarian technics. And a democratic technic is one that emerges from and leads to democratic power structures. An authoritarian technic is one that emerges from and leads to authoritarian power structures. And it's really pretty simple. A democratic technic is one that you and your community can control. So bows and arrows, we can make our own. On the other hand, guns, you're dependent upon mines, you're dependent on whoever makes the bullets. You're dependent upon, unless you live in a bat cave, you're dependent on, you know, gunpowder from somebody else. So it is controlled by others. So that makes it authoritarian because they can control you through it. We talked about agriculture, especially people earlier talked about agriculture, that it's authoritarian because it allows you to be controlled by others. And grocery stores are authoritarian because I'm controlled by others, as opposed to, why would I go to the grocery store when there's salmon in the stream behind my home? So gathering would be a democratic technique. And solar, passive solar, democratic technique. Solar photovoltaics, authoritarian technique. But they're authoritarian not only because they lead to authoritarian power structures, but they're authoritarian because the technology itself is authoritarian, and the technology itself ends up in charge. So once you create cars, the cars are in control. It's like I saw this cartoon years ago that was two machines talking, and one of them said, "We had them from the toaster." And the point is that global warming, yeah, it was happening way before, but the burning of oil is for industry. It's primarily for industry. It's almost exclusively for industry. 5 minutes. Okay. The drought in California. You know, we always hear you should take shorter showers and all that stuff, that we have to take responsibility for the drought. Bullshit. 90% of the water used by human beings is used by agriculture and industry. So if you take shorter showers, all it's going to do is ruin your social life. municipal golf courses use the same amount of water as municipal human beings. So the technique becomes in charge. That's how they can say it's a dilemma between fracking and drinking water, because the technology is in charge. So that's one of the ways that authoritarian techniques, I mean, we're sacrificing life on Earth rather than question the wisdom of buying into these techniques. And that's one of the ways an authoritarian technique is authoritarian. Like any other despot, it cannot be questioned, even when it's killing all we hold dear. And that's what we're up against. I mean, so where does all this leave us? It leaves us the same place we started, which is the world's being killed and we need to stop it. So I've already talked about what I think is necessary early on. Another way to think about that is to ask what Delta Smelt would do if they could take on human manifestation. And what would coho salmon do? And what would redwoods do? And what would prairies do? Another way to say all this is that so many indigenous people have said to me that the first and most important thing that we have to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds. That's also what we need to do to get over PTSD. We need to break our identification with the perpetrator. We need to break our addiction to the authoritarian techniques. We need to make our allegiance to the victims of this culture absolute. We need to make our allegiance to the land absolute. We need to make our allegiance to coho salmon and Pacific lamprey absolute. Our allegiance to Port Arthur cedar and Western lily absolute. We need to find what we love, and then we need to defend our beloved. This identification takes many forms. There was an essay by George Monbiot right after Fukushima in which one of the things he said is that nuclear power is great because of global warming, that we all need to do nuclear power, because how else are we going to get the power that we need to run our factories? I'm going to change a couple words that's going to change everything. How are the capitalists going to get the energy that they need to run their factories? And that's the split we need to make. It's not us needing electricity to run our factories, it's them needing electricity to run their factories. Once you break that split, everything else is technical. Then we can figure out how to do it. So I need to be clear about something else. Humans are not killing the planet. Industrial humans are killing the planet. Humans identify more with this culture than they do with life or killing the planet. Humans lived on this planet for tens or hundreds of thousands of years without destroying it. It's only in the last 6,000 years that a culture toxic enough to kill the planet has emerged. The choice we face is not between killing ourselves and killing the planet. The choice we face is continuing this way of life that's killing the planet and us or not. We can allow this culture to kill the planet, or we can bring down this culture. So what do I want you to do? I don't know you, and I don't know your gifts. So instead of me telling you what to do, I want you to ask yourself, what do you love? Whatever you love, it's under assault. Dig in and defend it. And what are your gifts? And people have said to me, God, Derek, you've written so many books. Why don't you quit now and be an organizer? Oh, for God's sake, I can't even organize my fucking backpack, you know? And also, it's like, I may not seem like it here, but I am an extreme introvert. And organizers have to do this horrible, they have to like talk to strangers. And I think I might rather the planet be killed. It's a joke, you know, but it's like, there are things that we can do and things that we can't do. Things that we, it's like, I don't want to be a fucking lawyer. And how? What are your gifts? And how can you use them in the service of your land base? What can you give back to the land who gave you your life? And what are the largest, most pressing problems that you can help to solve using the gifts that are unique to you and all the universe? The big distinction is not between those who believe in militant resistance and those who don't. I think those are important discussions to have, but the big distinction is between those who do something and those who do nothing. Do something. And finally, some good news. I often think about the partisans in World War II, and I think about them doing their part to bring down the Nazis. And then I think about an advantage that they had over us. They didn't have to defeat the Nazis by themselves. They had the Allies. For the longest time, this depressed the hell out of me. Where is a big Soviet army rumbling in, and where are the British and US bombers to destroy the Nazi war machines? There isn't one. But then I realized that I have been wrong all along. There is something much bigger than the Allies that will help us, and that's the real world. Life desperately wants to live. And from the smallest root reaching into the biggest dam, to the wildest hurricane and fastest tornado, who are doing what they can. To the leaf-scaled sea snakes and three-toed pygmy sloths and the Sumatran rhinos and the Cayman Islands ghost orchids, who are desperately trying to hang on until the non-human and human resistance kicks in to end this nightmare that's gone on for too long. The whole world is resisting. We have them on our side. So we don't have to do it by ourselves. We just have to join them. And we have to use our gifts and use your gifts, whatever they are, in the service of that greater good. So thank you very much.
Okay, I thought that was a lion's share. I think what we'll do is we'll share some of the music. I found this university, Anderson University, and it's just a beautiful show. So let's enjoy it, and we can play our other things. They'll be there next time. And so this is the title of this is called Candles. And it's about 44 minutes. So let's enjoy this. And let's take a deep breath and let it be a meditation and an upliftment. And what we've shared tonight, you know, bring us a deep inner insight, a greater insight to love. Okay. Here, let's see. Where do we go? We start here, I think.
Just a second. Gonna make a shift now.
That thing from the food we eat to the wars we fight all have their roots in the financial industry. So with this in mind, today we're going to take a look back at our best shows concerning how Wall Street affects the real world. Let's get to it and let's break the set. The financial crisis of 2008 was no doubt the worst economic catastrophe since the Great Depression. Besides the multitude of bankruptcies, bailouts, and austerity measures, the crisis also left a lasting impact on the amount of faith Americans have in Wall Street. In fact, according to a financial trust index poll from last year, only 22% of Americans said that they trust the financial system. And now there's yet another reason for the public to reject our crony capital system, and it doesn't even involve predatory lending or subprime mortgages. I'm talking about a little-known practice known as high-frequency trading. Essentially, this is a stock trading method that involves using incredibly advanced computer algorithms to buy and sell stocks at ideal prices just milliseconds before the general public can. And while a millisecond might seem trivial, when you're dealing with stocks, that can mean a difference of billions of dollars. And firms that engage in this technique are making enormous profits at the expense of regular investors. Now, last week, author Michael Lewis made waves across Wall Street with the release of his new book, Flash Boys, which exposes the shady world of high-frequency trading and highlights several stockbrokers who spoke out against the practice. Listen to how he described what those stockbrokers discovered nearly 6 years ago.
It's about a group of people who are actually on Wall Street who figure out kind of around 2008 that the stock market is all of a sudden something funny is happening. And it's not just the financial crisis. It's all of a sudden they look at their screens and the stock market says it's, you know, you can buy 50,000 shares of Microsoft at $20 a share. They go to buy it and it goes away. It goes away and the stock price goes up. And it's as if the market knows what they're going to do before they do it.
So how could the market pull a Miss Cleo and predict the future? Well, essentially, these high-frequency trading or HFT firms, are getting away with this technique through a number of eyebrow-raising, technologically ridiculous methods. Firstly, these firms build their computers right next to stock exchange servers so that their stock purchases are processed fractions of a second faster. Secondly, they use microwave towers, fiber optic cables, and even laser beams to facilitate transactions between markets in different cities much, much faster than any human could ever do. Finally, and most egregiously, these firms take advantage of something known as proprietary data feeds. And before your eyes start to glaze over, stay with me, because all you need to know is that there are two types of stock price information feeds. The first one is available to the general public, and it's what you see when you view the stock ticker on any financial channel. This public feed ensures that everyone has access to the same stock information at the same time. Then, there are proprietary information feeds, which stock exchanges sell to firms and investors willing to pay big bucks for it. And while legally stock information must be entered into both the public and proprietary feeds at the same time, the proprietary information is processed by these advanced computers faster than investors can keep up with the public feed. This leads to another huge advantage for these firms in allowing them to tell the way the market will shift before everyone else. And the people behind these exchanges are laughing all the way to the bank. In fact, between 2006 and 2012, NASDAQ's proprietary market data revenue more than doubled to $150 million. And over the past few years, high-frequency trading has gotten so out of control that just last Friday, Attorney General Eric Holder announced that the Justice Department is looking into whether the practice constitutes insider trading. But let's be honest. When Wall Street owns our politicians, reform is not exactly a top priority, guys. And really, can you blame them? Can you blame the economic elite for taking advantage of a system purposefully rigged to benefit them? Because if push comes to shove, there's no better way to skirt accountability than to hide behind a supercomputer that does your looting. Facing more than $18 billion in debt, the city of Detroit finally filed for bankruptcy last July. Yesterday, a U.S. District Court judge authorized the city to go forward with its filings for Chapter 9. Judge Stephen Rhodes said that negotiating and reaching a deal with the city's 100,000 creditors would have taken far too long and further prevented Detroit from delivering vital city services. Disturbingly, this ruling means that the pensions for thousands of Detroit city employees could be slashed, even though they were guaranteed long ago. So to break down the complexities of Detroit's bankruptcy and shed light on what this decision means for other cities in financial peril, I'm joined now by Richard Wolf, economist and professor emeritus at the University of Massachusetts. Always amazing to have you on, Richard.
Thank you for inviting me.
So, Richard, what do you think? Is this bankruptcy decision the best outcome for Detroit?
No, it's not. It's one of the worst outcomes. And I think you're right to point to this issue of the pensioners. It is a historic moment. It is saying to the workers of that city, and in fact to the workers of all this country, that when you sign a contract with an employer and you give up wages and benefits now to get a pension in the future, and the employer agrees with you to do that, that if and when that employer gets into difficulty, they can act as if they never made the commitment. They can forget all that you forwent, all that you did without to get a pension and take the pension away. When you add that the crisis in Detroit is because large corporations, General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler, decided it's more profitable to go elsewhere, they could leave behind that disaster and now make the people who worked for the city pay for it by being destitute in their old age. It is an amazing marker of where we have come as a country.
We've certainly come a far way, Richard, in the wrong direction. Let's talk about how Detroit got in this situation in the first place. You talked about the exodus of these auto companies. Also talk about how Wall Street was involved in bankrupting the city.
Well, you know, in the early years, because this decline of Detroit is a matter of several decades now, it speaks volumes to the incapacity of the governors of Michigan, to the presidents of the United States, to all the people that saw what was happening to step in and do something. But because they couldn't and they wouldn't bail out the city, even though they bailed out those auto companies, it left the city desperate. So they turned to Wall Street to get certain kinds of financial help to see them through the hard times. Now they've discovered that those very arrangements that Wall Street, quote unquote, helped them make turn out to have been profitable for Wall Street, but a further burden rather than a help on them, so that they've been hurt not only by the big oil companies, the big car companies, but also by the financial industries. And again, the failure of those arrangements is being taken out of the hides of the school teachers and the garden and park maintainers and the police and fire servers who worked a full lifetime for that city. It is astonishing to watch, and even if you don't understand the economics, the sheer morality of it is mind-blowing.
It is indeed. Let's get more into this pension issue. It's estimated that 23,000 retirees will see their pensions slash. I mean, is there any way to prevent this from happening, Richard?
Well, certainly. I mean, let's give you just two examples. One, the bailout at the highest estimates of the city's obligations to the pensioners is estimated to be $3.5 billion. By contrast, the federal government gave to General Motors $50 billion. General Motors is a company. Detroit is a city, which at that time of the bailout, almost a million people. Democracy alone would say, if you can bail out a company for $50 billion, you can find $3.5 billion to save thousands of people's pensions. But the second question is, do something in the relatively well-off state of Michigan to draw in the wealthy, the large corporations who have evaded their tax responsibilities for decades, and say to them, look, you've been making out like bandits. It's time for those at the top, the biggest and the richest, to pay what they should have been paying all along. And if you did that, you would be able to get the money that would be able to have this city honor its obligations to the people who gave lifetimes of work to maintaining that city.
Richard, you just hit it right on the head, which is that Detroit's auto industry has received a bailout many times over. Why is it that corporations are considered more important to bail out than the people of this country?
The irony is because they've made so much money that they have figured out that having become so rich relative to everybody else, both the big companies relative to businesses as a whole, and both the richest among us relative to everybody else, that they're so out of touch with everybody else that they better control the political system, or else the obvious will happen, that the majority will use the one person, one vote electoral system to undo the inequality generated by the economy. And so to prevent that, the corporations control the parties, the politicians, the think tanks. They give the money, they provide the support. And so our politics becomes more and more disconnected from what the mass of people in Detroit, but in the country as a whole, want. And we get these outcomes that make no sense and that contradict the first basis of any real democratic system.
And what do you think about the pushback argument that, you know, it's either pay these promised pension funds or keep utility services operating? You make the choice. I mean, of course, people are going to say, well, we have to keep the utility services operating.
That's a little bit like saying to a person on the street, I'm going to give you choice. You can either have me stab you or I will shoot you. The answer to that is never to argue which is the better way to go. The answer to that is to say, I don't accept that choice. And I don't accept the choice for Detroit of either cutting the pensions or cutting the utilities. My answer is, do something finally to correct the grotesque imbalances of wealth and power in the United States. Help the people who need it most, who've given the most, and who have the least responsibility for this crisis. They're the ones. The reason Detroit is in trouble is because this economic crisis has made so many people unemployed, unable to pay taxes, while a small percentage get very wealthy. Everyone knows that. Go after those people to raise the money they can best afford to do what's right by the people of this country. Or else you're driving a wedge inside the United States that we will all come to regret in the years ahead.
Absolutely. It is a false dichotomy. Thanks for breaking through that. Richard Wolff, economist, professor emeritus at University of Massachusetts. Thanks so much.
Welcome to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. Give us back our gold! One of the biggest themes of 2014, and no doubt 2015, as this long process of defiatization continues. Stacey.
Max, did you just make up that word?
Yeah, I just did, because I think you made it up, because I read it on the teleprompter and you wrote it.
Well, this defiatization process is in the first headline. This is Dow Jones Market Watch, and they're asking with great alarm, Europeans want their gold back, and why that's bad for the euro. Right across Europe over the course of the last year, a series of European countries have been demanding that their gold reserves, which are often stored in different nations, are brought back home. On the surface, that seems very odd. After all, gold has no meaningful role in the financial system anymore, and after a two-year bear market, it's not even worth as much as it was. It hardly seems worth the logistical or diplomatic hassle of bringing it back home.
Yeah, well, I remember Jim Jones out there in Guyana. He convinced everyone to drink the cyanide-laced Kool-Aid. Then they all died.
I survived.
Hale Bopp Comet cult. Remember? They're going to get on the Hale Bopp Comet and go meet somebody out there in outer space. So these policymakers and central bankers and central planners believe that fiat money has some intrinsic value, which of course it does not. And they want everyone to commit fiat suicide by embracing fiat paper nonsense over gold, except that a lot of people in Europe are now figuring out that this has been a huge con game, and when the music stops and only... those with gold are going to survive. They want their gold back. So this is just propaganda from American propagandists, and it's typical.
It's also a generational thing. So since 1971, there's been no gold standard around the world. So people assume, well, everything's been seemingly okay, despite all the boom and bust and all the crashes and inflation and sort of turmoil in the markets. Everything seems to be okay, relative, and it's 40 years that we haven't died, nothing's... But they forget about the thousands of years of history where... At the end of the day, as Alan Greenspan said, it's always gold in terms of a crisis is always accepted. And this is what he suggests could be happening in Europe in particular, because all these European nations want their gold back. And in particular, Netherlands, Germany, they've both started receiving gold. And now Austria has asked for its gold. It has 280 tons. 80% of it is here in London. So they want this back. And he's suggesting there are not many circumstances in which holding a big stash of gold on your own territory matters very much, but one of them is the sudden chaotic reorganization of your currency. If a country were to introduce a new currency overnight, then it could be backed by some gold right from the start that would give it some instant credibility in the markets. Repatriating gold only makes sense as a way of preparing for that to happen. So he says that he thinks these European nations think that the euro is going to fall apart, but I posit that China and Russia are also buying huge quantities of gold. Turkey, India, other places are buying gold. So I think it's the whole thing is falling apart.
Well, look what happened in Russia recently. The ruble made a move from 40 to the dollar to 80 to the dollar, and the gold price skyrocketed. So anybody holding gold in Russia, their effect their experience with the ruble fluctuations was exactly zero. Their wealth did not budge one iota because they held gold. Gold acted exactly as you would in a currency crisis. Another thing is that, as you mentioned, we went up to gold standard in 1971. The world embarked for the first time in a fiat currency standard for the first time in history. What has happened since then? Well, debt around the world has skyrocketed to 300% or more of GDP globally. Never happened before ever in history. And number two, the wealth and income gap is skyrocketing to extremes also never before seen in history. Also, the bond market has never been as overcooked in the UK as it has been now in over 300 years. In over 240 years in America, we've never seen bonds as highly priced as they are now. All these things happened because of abandonment to the gold standard. And now, as this whole thing is becoming a big flaming ball of nonsense and a meteor of fiat currency is about to impact planet Earth, and of course, people are buying gold once again. And the sad part is when you go out there to buy the gold in the panic, there will be none for sale.
Exactly. And that's what Sandeep Jaitley, but Professor Fricketts in particular, has said on the Kaiser Report many times over the past year or two, is that people won't comprehend it. This guy is struggling to understand it, but one day there will be no price. You won't be able to buy it for a trillion Zimbabwe dollars or a trillion US dollars or a trillion rubles. There will be no fiat price for it because nobody will want to exchange it. Right now, you can they're paying you fiat actually to lend them your gold. You're making a lot of free money and you get your gold back. So we'll talk about that with Sandeep Jaitley in the second half. But on top of this, you know, this is another big, big trend, and it's a multi-year, could be multi-decade trend, as when the British empire collapsed, it took, 20, 30, 40 years. I think we're also seeing the same thing with the U.S. because remember, China passed in purchasing power parity our GDP in the U.S. So we see that in this next headline. You mentioned the ruble crisis. Well, in step China. China offers Russia help with currency swap suggestion. China will provide help if needed and is confident Russia can overcome its economic difficulties. Foreign Minister Wang Yi was cited as saying in Bangkok in a December 20th report by Hong Kong-based Phoenix TV. Commerce Minister Gao Hucheng said expanding a currency swap between the two nations and making increased use of yuan for bilateral trade would have the greatest impact in aiding Russia, according to the broadcaster. But according to the experts and analysts interviewed in this, it also allows for the yuan to become a world reserve currency as well.
What did Horace Greeley say? Go east, young man. No, that's a revision. That's the new version. That's the Horace Greeley 2.0. Yeah, of course, China, Russia, they're doing currency swaps. They are aggressively buying gold. They're waiting for that moment in history when the dollar finally gives it all, gives up the ghost, and we've got a new global currency standard that's probably backed in part by gold.
And at the end of the year, China said that they wanted to, the president of China said that they wanted to adopt a big country diplomacy. So they're getting ready to take their place on the world stage. This is, again, like a very long process. It's been happening for the last 10, 15, 20 years, and it will take another 10, 20 years for there to be a truly at least bipolar world, but maybe a multipolar world. And China is promoting the yuan as an alternative to the dollar for global trade and finance. And the PBOC, the People's Bank of China, has signed currency swap agreements with 28 other central banks to encourage this. The nation's foreign exchange reserves of $3.89 trillion are the world's largest and compare with Russia's $374 billion. So they already entered in a currency swap with Argentina. Remember, they helped save the Argentinian peso. And now they stepped in with a currency swap back in October for 150 billion yuan, which is about $24 billion with the currency swap with Russia.
Well, the U.S. is just not standing by and letting this go without some kind of response. I mean, George Clooney and Jim Carrey are going to war with North Korea to defend the interests of Sony. So, you know, this is what America will hopefully survive in the 21st century if people can download and pay huge tariffs to Hollywood cartel, copyright cartel. As long as that's preserved, then America should be fine.
And also this article mentions that China and Russia is an irreplaceable partner. Russia is an irreplaceable strategic partner on the international stage, according to an editorial in the Global Times, a Beijing-based daily affiliated with the Communist Party. China must take a proactive attitude in helping helping Russia walk out of the current crisis. So again, this is another important thing is as an empire is rising, they're very nice. They want to make good. They want to globalize the world, not deglobalize the world. That's another trend we saw in 2014 was the deglobalization happening rapidly via the U.S., just like the British Empire. When they were falling, they deglobalized the world because they weren't the winners anymore. They didn't like the setup anymore when they were no longer the winners. So we're going to go through another few years, I think, of this turmoil.
It's like Muhammad Ali, George Foreman's fight when he had knocked him out, basically, and he could have put in another punch there, but he let him just step back and let him fall in this spectacular crash.
Yeah.
Or as maybe as Putin would say, why should we be chasing the piglets when we could be eating honey and berries? You know, I mean, that those are words that will resonate throughout 2015.
Yes. And also, the U.S. dollar is obviously the world's reserve currency, but it's been shrinking as in terms of percentage of trade. It's down now to like 60% when it was up at 80% only a decade ago. But it's become just a pure poker chip now. It's no better than going into any casino and in Vegas or in Macau, and now it's a genuine just a currency of gambling because surging U.S. dollar threatens emerging markets carry trades. Now, this was from September, and of course, it got worse from there into the end of the year as a carry trade, the dollar carry trade unwinded. There were between 2 and 7 trillion, depending on who you read, of carry trades based on the borrowing in the dollar for 0% and lending in emerging markets for higher percent, maybe it was only 4 or 5% at the height of the insanity of the QE-driven 0% interest. So here we see that several analysts sense danger in the air. The carry trade strategies are finally cracking, said Luis Costa, currency strategist at Citibank. The market has been so flooded with liquidity and interest rates have been so low for so long, but this is turning now, just at the same time that China passed and the purchasing power parity, the U.S. economy.
Currency carry trades, we usually associate them with the yen carry trade, the Swiss franc carry trade, where you're getting an interest rate pickup by borrowing in yen or Swiss franc. But when you talk about the U.S. dollar as involved in carry trades, we're talking about the quadrillion big derivatives market around the world. All derivatives are priced essentially in dollars. You know, commodities like gold and oil are priced in dollars. So when we talk about the carry trade in dollars, we're talking about the global derivatives market, of which is now worth over a quadrillion in dollars. And as the deflationary forces continue to spiral downward and suck the balance sheets of the central banks and various other banks into the abyss, there's actually a shortage of dollars. There's a need to print lots of more bonds. I mean, bond prices typically can go up because there's a huge demand to settle out on these derivative trades that are now going bust. But the dollar improving, going higher in 2015, it does set up really an enormous conflict around the world because you're going to have a scramble for resources. Agriculture, energy, space, water, all resources are going to be, there's going to be a huge scramble. So we're setting the stage now for a global conflict. And we see a precursor to that in the currency Forex trading every single day now. And newcomer Russian ruble, which has never been in the Forex market before, is now getting a foothold in there. In 2015, you'll see that come on.
Well, this carry trade thing, it can destroy economies. You remember Iceland when that collapsed? That was due to the unwinding of a carry trade. Yes, there was a lot of banking fraud, but this was the unwinding of a carry trade. So Malaysia, for example, 45% of all their debt is held by these carry traders. Poland, Hungary, and Mexico, also 35% of all their debt is held by these people speculating with the carry trade. So the currency risk, what happens? The currency goes up, people start to lose money, they unwind the trade, chaos ensues.
And Iceland's a good example of what can happen when things fall apart. And so this is basically 2015, looks like, when really all this kind of unwinds. All right, so Stacey, you've got to go, thanks.
Woohoo! Defiatization!
Well, I see this isn't your first time to the Forex Rodeo. Well, stay tuned for the second half, a whole lot more.
Momentito.
Welcome back to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. Time now to turn to Sandeep Jaitley of FaketaResearch.com. Sandeep, welcome back to the Kaiser Report.
Thanks, Max. All right, let's first talk about a topic you have introduced to the audience, and I think we need to follow up on it. GoFo. So GoFo, a big story of 2014. Remind the audience what GoFo is, why it's unusual at the moment.
GoFo is the gold. It stands for the gold offered forward rate, and it's basically it's the amount. It's the rate at which you can borrow dollars, giving gold as collateral on the other side of that loan. So, if it's 0.5%, it basically means for whatever maturity you're talking about, you can borrow dollars for 0.5% less than you could if you weren't using gold as collateral. So that's what GoFo means. It's like a gold LIBOR. So when GoFo goes negative, it basically means that if you've got gold to give as collateral, you can get a dollar loan on a negative basis. So if you're borrowing $1 million, you only need to return back $1 million less this amount. So
why it means if it's negative, it means that demand for physical is quite high.
Well, yes, because obviously there are two sides to a trade. So the other side of that trade is they must need your gold.
Right. And so we have to there's huge demand for gold, physical gold.
Yeah, we should stop talking about it in terms of physical gold, and we should just say gold and not gold, you know. Gold in the hand is all that there is. You know, there is no...
Right, but we make the distinction because in the paper gold market, yes, like the COMEX, people dump paper gold and keeps the price at a level that doesn't seem to represent the true demand as represented by this GoFo rate, which is that it's gone negative. The demand is so high, people are willing to take a loss on the gold just to get their hands on the gold.
It's not a loss on the gold, Max, because you get your gold back at the end of the period. So the question is, why are they giving free fiat for your gold? Will you get your gold back at the end of the period is the question that more and more people will ask themselves in this realm of the...
And kind of a strange corollary to this, not to totally bamboozle the mind of the listener out there, but in Europe now we're seeing more and more negative interest rates.
Yes.
Okay, so it's kind of, there's a connection here.
Yes.
Which, at the risk of diving headlong into an enormous pool of futures contracts technical speak, let's talk about negative interest rates for a second in Europe. In other words, when you put your money in the bank, they don't give you nothing. As a matter of fact, they take it.
Yeah.
So...
Well, they want you to spend it. They want you to spend it. They're fed up with them monetizing these fiat bonds, quantitative easing. So they're swapping all of these demand deposits for treasury bonds in the market, and we're not there doing anything with it. I say we, it's obviously a different set of people, but they're not there doing anything with it. So what better way to make them do something with that than by cutting it, basically, and saying if you don't spend it, we'll cut it.
Right. So the zero bound on interest rates is viewed as the absolute lowest you can go. And this is what governments have pursued to try to stimulate the economies by making, you know, interest rates zero interest rate policy or ZIRP. But they don't get any inflation. There's still a huge deflation. In other words, the balance sheets of these banks are still crumbling. So, but the zero is not the ultimate place you can go. You can go negative. You can go to negative interest rates where they charge you to hold your money with the idea that they don't want you to keep your money in the bank. They want you to go out there and circulate the money.
Yes.
Stop saving. Stop being sovereign. Stop being an individual. Stop being freedom-loving sovereign types. Go out and spend everything. Go into debt.
They want you to, I mean, it's their money to begin with, you know, so they can tell you.
When you put money in the bank, they own the money. It's not your money anymore.
Well, it never was. Fiat money is never, it's not your money. It's their money always. Don't forget that.
All right, so interest rates tell an interesting tale. So in the case of the banks, they're going to negative interest rates. In the case of GoFo rates, just taking another pass at this, in other words, the rate on the in this contract is such where you don't lose gold, as you point out.
No. But say you have 100 ounces of gold, and you're tempted by this offer. So you give your 100-ounce bar to your banker, your bullion banker, and he gives you a loan for, let's say, however many, let's say, $120,000, of which you only need to return $119,000. And at the end of that period, you get your 100-ounce bar of gold back.
Right. So
you got $1,000 free.
Right. You got $1,000 free.
Yeah.
And this is unusual. Free money.
It shouldn't happen.
Right. It's free money.
It shouldn't happen if you believe that fiat is money, which, of course, no sane person does believe that fiat is money.
Right. This is free money, which in a system that where people are trading at billions of times a second and all arbitrage spreads are eliminated, and yet this is a huge arbitrage spread.
Huge. It's massive. That's why they're not publishing GOFO from the end of January, because you have to call up your banker and find out what the rate is directly from them. Because
either this is a price signal is wrong or the market's screwed up.
Or both. I mean,
but the price signal is not wrong in that it is the signal. But it's very easy,
as you said, manipulate the price. It's very hard to manipulate GOFO to become positive again, because there are all of these obligations denominated in gold terms. The Bank of the Central Bank of Brazil has just realized that the way that it owns its gold is not commensurate with actually getting gold, which was similar to the Bank of Portugal when Central Bank of Portugal when Lehman's went under.
So let's talk about countries for a second, because on the sovereign scale, Netherlands is repatriating 122 tons of gold from the New York Fed. Austria, perhaps next up. So as you point out, the market's screwed up. Yeah. It's obviously been the GOFO rates where you get free money, essentially. So countries are looking at this and saying, wait a minute, you know, we're not stupid. This looks like the fiat money is about to collapse. We want our physical gold back. Yeah. And so this is a huge trend right now, right?
It seems like you can't have your gold back and the fiat money system surviving. So this is going to be a very interesting evolution, all of this central bank.
And, of course, you have big players like China, Russia have been buying gold very aggressively. There's a rumor out there during the ruble when it was down recently that Russia was selling their gold. That was quickly disproved. In fact, they're buying more gold, correct?
Yes, I would imagine so. I don't have any greater knowledge.
Right now, a few years ago, you told us here on Kaiser Report that central banks would take us back to the Stone Age with experiments in quantitative easing. Okay, here we are at the end of 2014. It looks like they're winning. You know, equity and property prices are up. Commodities are down. Where are we in the story?
We aren't over in that in the story yet, Max. I mean, you know, they say that they're finishing QE. It's not strictly true, you know, because whatever is on the balance sheet of the Fed currently is going to mature within X months. So within X months, they'll need to buy another lot of treasury bonds on the open market.
When you talked about this a year ago or so, did you, in your calculations, count on banks being able to get away with going to negative interest rates as they are doing? Or was that at the time you're thinking, well, they would probably not, they would never get away with doing that?
I always thought the Swiss would try something like that because they think like that.
But now it's moving to all over Europe.
It's moving. It's the mentality is moving. Yeah, everywhere.
Okay. So your thesis basically, the reason it's taking perhaps longer is because of this negative interest rate environment, which is really just making the problem worse. So that when the proverbial
they will start spending it. There's no question. You know, I mean, the German mindset is obviously to save the banknotes. You know, that rather than spend them, but it went. I don't know what it will take. But they will start spending them very quickly.
Here in the UK, the UK gilt market, the good sovereign, the government bond market, it's at a 350-year high.
Yeah.
So prices for bonds haven't been this high for 350 years, since the beginning, really, of the Bank of England. Yields are at a 350-year low, obviously. So the national debt keeps rising. So what happens when if rates at some point they just, you know, every season has a cycle. I mean, the worth, you know, things go around. I mean, our interest rates cannot just go negative and down for eternity.
It won't. it will all cancel itself somehow, you know. And the question is, I don't know how it will cancel itself, but just like it was created out of nowhere, that's where it will go back to. You know, these debts aren't real debts. You know, this money isn't real money. Just how it cancels itself is the interesting game going forward.
Now, your mentor, I think, is safe to say, Professor Fekete, who, you know, he's been on the show a few times, and I must say he's a bit of a chick magnet. You know, the women love this guy. I don't know what it is. He's got that spark, that Hollywood pizzazz. He's like the George Clooney of monitors. So he was saying, you know, buy bonds. It's a guaranteed way to make money because, you know, he never really, you know, we were shaking him like, Professor, what are you saying? It's crazy, but yet he's been right now for years.
The only problem with that, Max, is that if you want to
question the professor,
that, I had to question him. You have to be out of your gold and your silver and in bonds to make that trade. And when you want to get back into your gold and silver from all of your fantastic bond fiat trading rubbish profits, you won't be able to. So that's the dichotomy, you know, that you have playing the fiat game. Is that, yeah, of course, you can make a fortune from this capital appreciation and gilts and all of this rubbish. But it's all in fiat terms. It doesn't mean anything. And when you want to exchange it for something that matters to you on a subjective basis, then it will all be exposed for what it is, which is a charade.
That Fekete knew best all along. That's what we're talking about. Now, we got about a minute left. You know, recently there's been a lot of action in the currency pits, you know, trading pits, particularly in the ruble. Because the ruble is only not even 1% of global Forex. And they just really cut it loose recently to let it trade freely on the Forex exchange. And it got, you know, it was a baptism by fire.
Yeah.
It got, like, hammered. And then they figured out, oh, my God, you know, how do we play this game? And now it's already come back substantially because they're figuring out exactly how to play the Forex war as it is.
Yeah.
But a quick question is, if you were a central banker in Russia and you really wanted to stick it to the pound and the dollar, wouldn't you collapse the COMEX in New York by taking physical delivery of gold and thus setting in motion a huge price spike in gold and destroying fiat?
Well, if I were of, let's say, a villainous inclination, you know, I think COMEX have rules against one individual doing that kind of thing. Now, groups of individuals is another matter, you know, and but of course, demanding contractual delivery for things like that is something that anyone who has a COMEX contract can, but then they can settle in fiat. Is there?
Yeah, they can settle in fiat. But anyway, it's an interesting theory.
There are other ways beyond that.
Okay, well, we'll explore those next time here. Sandeep, thanks for being on the Kaiser Report.
Thanks, Max.
All right, well, that's going to do it for this edition of the Kaiser Report with me, Max Kaiser, and Stacey Herbert. I'd like to thank our guest, Sandeep Gately. If you'd like to get in touch, tweet us a Kaiser Report. Until next time, bye, y'all.
Okay, the little pond in the garden had a peculiar kind of creature, which, for lack of a better term, I shall call it a spring fairy. The pond is fed by several springs, and in the particular places where this water up from the earth, there were strange, long creatures with something of a jellyfish appearance. Their most definite part is a bluish, dimly featured head, which melts into a bluish body.
It's all of me. I think I'm here three times. I can't get everything turned off. I got to close my computer down and start over or something.
Oh, I guess she's not there now. Oh, my goodness. Okay, so we're talking about the most definite part of the tree spirit is a bluish, dimly featured head, somebody wants to go out, which melts into a bluish body with very little suggestion of neck between. The body fades away into vague, wraith-like tendrils and continues down into the earth for a considerable distance. These creatures seem to draw their life from within the earth. Although they are at the same time definitely connected with water, it is evident that spring water has a kind of vital freshness about it that is the source of their life. These quaint spring fairies generally hover at the place where the water emerges from the earth, their heads just out of the water, bobbing slowly up and down. It is a little glazed hothouse I found. In a little glazed hothouse, I found a few fairies of the butterfly variety, longer by an inch or two than others of their type, and more human also, yet otherwise much the same. Evidently, after a term of hothouse experience, the butterfly type has become specialized for this special contact with the work of humans in forcing plants. They are delicate and dainty beings. There are other kinds of beings which are an integral part of the life of the garden. The trees. In the center of this garden, for instance, there was a large, handsome, freestanding, and solitary hickory tree. The aggregation of the vitality of all the living cells in this tree combines to make up the life of an entity which we might call the tree spirit. Thus, there is a being that lives, as it were, with the tree as his body, or merging with it. He is an integral part of the tree itself and cannot move about, away from the tree any distance, as the fairies can move among their shrubs. Indeed, there are no trees without tree spirits. The spirit is not always visible, for it only appears when it desires to do so. However, the consciousness of the tree can project itself externally on occasion and take form. This form, again, usually has a human semblance, yet looks much more like an elongated, full-size shadow of a human being, very long and very thin. Some of these tree spirits are strong individualities, yet of course the majority are rather undistinguished. This old hickory tree was charming and delightful, and its spirit, whenever it takes form, is rather like a tall brown American Indian shape, with a brown, rather bark-like skin, high nose, vague hair, and two pinpoints of black for eyes. He is not exactly beautiful, yet he has great charm, and is exceedingly cheerful and friendly. In some ways, he gives one the feeling of a cheerful, wise old person with quite a whimsical personality. Dawn is a busy time in the garden. As always, at this time of the day, a special blessing is poured out upon the world. There is an awakening of energy. And the fairies are kept busy, receiving this and disseminating it. It also begins the activities of their day. At dawn, they come back from play to work once more. The fairies think of the sun as a tremendous, life-giving globe of light, which is the source of all life. As they derive their nourishment as principally from the sun's rays, they seem to draw the rays of the sun through their bodies. Now this is the nearest they come to eating. Apart from deriving energy for the maintenance of their own bodies, they help to guide the energy from the sun for the plant's growth. Fairies have a delightful relationship with trees, looking upon them as companions who are not so highly evolved as themselves, yet have the special merit of being solid, of being substantial citizens. They like trees and think of them as respectable and worthy of and fine, yet at the same time, they feel rather superior to them, because trees cannot move about. Okay, Commander Doug, can you try her again now? I'm just not sure. Are you there? I'm kind of concerned again. It looks like I'm not sure. We wouldn't be on there if we were. It says group call. Doug, write to us if you can hear us. I'm concerned as to whether we're even there after you hung her up. All right, you got to go call him again. There's no two ways about it. Something weird is going on, and I don't know if I'm reading to the wall. Hello, everybody. Am I reading to the tree spirit itself? Oh, gosh. Fairies have a delightful relationship with trees, looking upon them as companions who are not so highly evolved as themselves, yet have the special merit of being solid, substantial citizens. They like trees, and they think of them as respectable and worthy and fine, yet at the same time, they feel rather superior to them, because trees cannot move about. Fairies take a great friendly interest in all, you got to go in a different room, Rama, in all animals. And in this garden, there are some widgeon ducks and white swans. The fairies often come down. I hope I'm on the air. Am I on the air? Did you ask him, Ron? Okay. Let's see if we can try to get Rainbird back up here. Otherwise, if she can't get... Oh, there we see. We see her lovely... Oh, there you are. Okay. Okay. All right, let me read the last paragraph here.
Oh, gosh, you're just teasing me. Go ahead.
Fairies take a great friendly interest in all animals, and in this garden there are some widgeon ducks and white swans. The fairies often come down or look down upon the water from the slope above to watch the antics of these ducks with great delight. There is a close tie with these birds, and the fairies often move among them freely. Huh. Regarding, turn the page, I'll finish this paragraph, I'm almost done. Regarding them much as we do dogs, except that they feel slightly more of a sense of equality with the birds. Hey, Rainbird, you're right there in the right place. They would always try to help these birds as much as they could, and the birds respond. For like many animals, they do see fairies. And I pass this talking stick, Excalibur, Rainbow Rose, Quetzalcoatl, Emerald Serpent Feathered talking stick, to my sister with a bit of fairy dust to you. Now.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
Nice.
Bye.
So, thank you, Tara and Rama, for a lovely, lovely day and a long one, but it really went fast.
It did.
It was busy. So lots of good inspiration and information and new friends. And so much gratitude for all of our lives and all the different ways that we show up in our lives and how we weave in the Sat Yuga. Or just jump right into it and do it anyway. Well, however our approach, we're grateful for all of our lives. And so 13 thank yous and honey in the heart. And Happy New Year, Happy Kwanzaa, Merry Christmas, and Happy Hanukkah, and Maliki Manaka, whatever.
Maliki Manaka. That was cute. I got to say,
you worked on it. It's up to you to wish us that Hawaiian holiday. So I pass this talking stick.
Okay, just momentito, because I got to go find it in here. Oh, dear. Here it is. Okay. Melakalikimaka e ha'u'oli makahiki how. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. And now we're going to hear from our brother, Poems by Rumi by Coleman Barks and Robert Bly. Here we go.
For 60 years, I have been forgetful every minute. But not for a second has this flowing toward me stopped or slowed. I deserve nothing. Today I recognize that I am the guest the mystics talk about. I play this living music for my host. I play this living music for my host. Everything today is for the host. Everything today is for the host.
My poems resemble the bread of Egypt. One night passes over them, and you can't eat them anymore. So gobble them down now, while they're still fresh, before the dust of the world settles on them. Where a poem belongs is here, in the warmth of the chest. Out in the world, it dies of cold. You've seen a fish, put him on dry land. He quivers for a few moments, and then he's still. And even if you eat my poems while they're still fresh, you still have to bring forward many images yourself. Actually, my friend, what you're eating is your own imagination. These poems are not just a bunch of old proverbs.
Forget your life. Say God is great. Get up. You think you know what time it is. It's time to pray. You've carved so many little figurines, too many. Don't knock on any random door like a beggar. Reach your long hand out to another door, beyond where you go on the street. The street where everyone says, "How are you?" And no one says, "How aren't you?" Tomorrow you'll see what you've broken and torn tonight, thrashing in the dark. Inside you, there's an artist you don't know about. He's not interested in how things look different in moonlight. If you're here unfaithfully with us, you're causing terrible damage. If you've opened your love to God's love, You're helping people you don't know.
That's right.
And have never seen.
That's right.
Is what I say true? Say yes quickly.
Yes.
If you know. If you've known it. From before the beginning of the universe. A new rambunctious craziness comes, dragging our chains, tearing and spilling the full sacks. Some nameless Bedouins buy Joseph for 18 coins, and that story begins again. All night, we pasture on jasmine and narcissus. We leap up for the dawn. Anemones sprout in the stone cracks and the trees. God has given a new world. You lover, you Gnostic, you friend, God has chosen you to read this poem out loud, because you're the one with the love bites on you. Don't say anything. Go outside. Take a long walk and just look.
The master, who lives in both worlds at once, changes the student. That's not unusual. People rise from the dead in the saint's head all the time. And the tiniest of these miracles is this. Everyone near a saint gets drunk with God. When such a man lets the water hold up his feet, we are moved because, by ways we cannot see, the sight of that links the soul back to the source of all lightness. Of course, a holy man can move a mountain, but who cares about that? Of course, a holy man can move a mountain, but who cares about that? How marvelous is the bread made without dough, the dishes of food that are invisible, Mary's grapes that never saw the vine.
Very interesting. What it was saying on there is all this written material about forgiveness, and I saw this one part where it said, I believe all things are connected, and that every river connects to the same sea. And many beautiful things that we already talk about. So we'll let the sound carry us to our dwelling in our hearts here tonight and on the bridge and in our dreams. And one thing that was said here that I was listening to on the Rumi start point there is that when we do with intention together these things, we are helping people that we don't know in ways that we don't know. And that is a truly powerful thought concept, which is real. And that's the power of coming together and doing things together like this. It is magnified as it's said 100 times, 1,000 times, 1,000,000 times, 1,000,000,000 times, 1,000,000,000,000 times, and everything beyond that. And that counters all this games that has nothing but the goal of materialism, which brings no happiness in the end. We are here and we are made to share and made to love. Let us love and ask for more than love we know, because there is all infinite possibilities. And let's do this, come together like this again tomorrow and Monday night with Cheryl Croce, the same number, 860-970-0300. And the PIN code is 946-7441#. And we will see you there and in our hearts. Let's stay connected until we meet again. And most of all, love yourself as you would love the world. We are all one. Inshallah, I am another yourself. And Sat Nam.
Sat Nam Ji.
Aho Mitakuyasin. Namaste, everybody.